If we could grab our seats and we'll go ahead and get fired up here. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Jim, is this our 10th meeting?
11th.
11th meeting. So I want to compliment you all for your diligence. Some of the usual suspects, you've made almost every meeting. I think almost everybody here has made almost every meeting. So thank you very much for your diligence and meeting almost monthly since January. So let's first start off with introductions. Senator, let's start with you, and we'll go around the room, and we'll even have the audience introduce themselves, too.
Senator Doug Whitsett, Senate District 28.
Glad to have you here, Senator.
Kenji Sugar, Executive Director of Oregon Bicycle Racing Association, also Oregon Tourism Commissioner.
James Nash, Six Ranch, Six Ranch Fly Fishing.
Rob Morrison, Vice President of Global Marketing for Leupold & Stevens.
Claire Pucci, retired from a number of different positions.
Paul Don Hefner, Oregon Hunters Association.
Mark Labhart, Tillamook County. And I had the privilege of using a Leupold scope a couple weeks ago. A week ago. It did me a very good job, too.
Rob Ball, Nature Conservancy Board.
Scott Welch, Senior Global Manager, Corporate Relations, Columbia Sportswear.
Nancy Bales, Executive Director at the Gray Family Foundation.
Carrie Westland, CEO of Travel Lane County, marketing the Eugene Cascades and Coast Region.
Jim Martin, fish biologist representing the sport fishing industry.
Jim Owens, Cogan Owens Green facilitator.
Roger Furman, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Director's Office, and Kurt will be here shortly. He had an appointment at 1 o'clock.
Beth Petrino, Legislative Committee staff.
Okay, and in the back of the room, please.
Oregon Wildlife Society, Bob Olson, Tom Wolf, Travel Unlimited.
Will Al Meyer with the Oregon Conservation Network.
Jim Meyer, representing the Chiefs River Alliance.
Roman Rose, Executive Director of the Capital State.
Cameron Smith, OBF.
Kevin Blakely, Oregon Fish and Wildlife Division.
Carl Bentley.
Fergus McLean, I'm a candidate for House 7 from the Independent Pacific Green and Progressive Party.
Thank you, Lynch. Thank you, wonderful support.
Greg Hunter, for St. Louis Fish and Wildlife Division.
Great, glad to have you here. And on the phone?
Bruce Taylor, Task Force member.
Bruce Taylor.
Bruce Taylor. Okay, glad to have you, Bruce. Christine, you didn't introduce yourself.
Christine Braniak, Legislative Revenue Office.
Okay. And the Fish Division just walked in. Would you introduce yourself?
I'm Ed Bowles, OVFW.
Okay. Anybody else on the phone? Okay. Glad to have you all here. So if you'll pull up your agenda and take a look at it, we've got a number of really important decisions to make today. Our meeting objectives are pretty aggressive. Discuss the options to the income tax surcharge exemptions for license holders that acknowledge the historical contributions of hunters and fishers to ODIF's conservation objectives. Our second objective is to share the results of additional outreach plan and an additional outreach to the public and to our legislators. Clarify nexus between the funding recommendations and objectives and legislation. Clarify the connection between with House Bill 3315 and develop proposed approach that responds to the results of House Bill 3315. Further define our recommendations as needed for the report and answer the question, you know, what will be our process? What will be our process and how we'll finish that? And then plan contacts with legislators and additional stakeholders above and beyond what we've already done. So in terms of, we've got a few housekeeping items, and Jim, I'll have you cover those, and then we'll go to some reports from the members.
Sure. And political season, so there's plenty of fodder out there, so I've tried to find a neutral story for you. An airplane's about to crash. There are five passengers on board, but only four parachutes. The first passenger says, "I am President Obama, the chosen one. The world needs me. I can't afford to die." So he takes the first parachute and jumps out of the plane. The second passenger, Julia Gillard, said, "I'm the Prime Minister of Australia, and I'm the smartest woman in Australian history, so Australia's people don't want me to die." She takes a second parachute and jumps out of the plane. The third passenger, John Kerry, says, "I'm a senator and a decorated war hero from the Army of the United States of America." And he grabs the parachute next to him and jumps. The fourth passenger, ex-president George W. Bush, says to the fifth passenger, who's a 10-year-old schoolgirl, "I've lived a full life and I've served my country the best I could. I'll sacrifice my life and let you have the last parachute." The little girl says, "That's okay, Mr. President. There's a parachute left for you. Australia's smartest woman took my school bag."
That was good.
Okay. That was actually one of your better ones. Okay.
So it only takes 11 meetings to get there.
That was
so in terms of supporting materials, we sent you out a summary for the last meeting, which was 6 weeks ago. We put together a package of all the communications we've received since that meeting. We sent out an outdated summary of the outreach with stakeholder groups, and we'll come back and talk about that as an agenda item. Then there's a memo on a work group that staff convened, and we'll go through that in detail. And then lastly, we sent out an update to the funding alternatives, and that will also be an agenda item. So hopefully you received all those materials. And the only other housekeeping item is that we are planning one more meeting of this group. We'll need to make that decision collectively at the end of this meeting, but staff's hope is that be able to wrap this process up with an additional meeting, and we scheduled that for November 28th. And our goal will be to make that a meeting / social event as well. But we'll talk about that towards the end of this meeting.
Okay, thank
you. That's all I have.
Okay, we had some other guests walk in. If you introduce yourself, please. Great, glad to have you here. Oh, and one more. Great, thank you. Okay, reports from members, and these are not reports on outreach that you've done, but any reports, and I think Claire has one that's kind of interesting. She's been contacted by a group and is going to be doing something about it.
So. Yeah, I was contacted just last week, I guess it was, by the editor of a professional journal called The Wildlife Professional. It's out of Bethesda, Maryland, and it's a journal for professional wildlife biologists. And they got wind of the fact that there is a task force working on what we're working on, and they thought that this would be of interest to their readers, so they've asked me to write an article for the magazine. Unfortunately, it won't come out until next summer. And so the deadline is March, so we're probably going to be somewhere in the process, and I'll just keep you in the loop as this goes forward.
So I was kind of giving her a little bit of a hard time. I said, well, hopefully it'll be an article that shows how great our success was with the legislature and what we've made it through, and that the process was very good, but it's yet to be determined, so we'll see. Now, any other reports from members and not related to, we'll talk a little bit about some of our outreach stuff, but any other reports? Okay, well then let's move right into approval of our September 16th minutes, and that was very well done again by Alicia and Jim. Thank you again for your good work on that. So is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, motion is approved. Now let's move to public comment. I see that we've had three people sign up. Peggy, come on up. With the League of Women Voters. Welcome, Peggy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. My testimony follows up the work that the League did during last session on House Bill 2402 and what we do every session related to budgets for the Natural Resource Agencies as well as policy. You have in your packet an email that I sent to the director, Kurt Melcher, regarding our continued advocacy for the beverage tax rather than the income tax surcharge. It really does relate to, it took you an hour to have the argument and you're still in the process of trying to decide what to do with people who buy licenses and then how they would be treated related to the income tax surcharge. And I just think that that will be a contentious issue that won't get us to discussing what we need for funding for ODF&W. And so that's the reason that I continue to advocate for that. And when I did the math, I thought, you know, it's really pretty cheap for individuals. And you can see that in my memo as well. The other points I want to make, though, is that House Bill 2402's task force charge included number four, prioritize actions and allocation of resources that provide for the long-term sustainability of the department and its ability to achieve its mission. You obviously did not have the time in the short number, even though they've been lots of meetings, in the short time you've had, you have focused on the funding. The League felt that that fourth priority was really important to have that conversation. So at minimum, what we're asking is that you be sure and note in your report to the legislature that this is an important function that needs to continue. And either this task force or a new one needs to have that conversation. And I will tell you that in part, we have got to have the budget fleshed out. And I will recognize Senator Whitsitt's comments related to this because he feels really strongly, as I have read the minutes, then in fact, that needs to be done. We need to know exactly what it is that ODF&W needs. We have these large numbers, $9 million here and X number there and so on. But I have to tell you that when I advocate for specific agency budgets, they are very specific in nature as to how much each subset is going to, what it's going to buy. How many FTEs it's going to buy, should they be full-time, part-time, are there supplies, contracts, how it's all going to work. So before I go to the legislature in 2017 and help advocate for more funding for ODF&W, and we believe passionately that that is what is needed, I need help. And so the agency and or yourselves in dealing with this need to recognize this. And I noticed that Senator Johnson, and I read through the notes, and Senator Johnson in the Coastal Caucus also had a question. And one of her questions had to do with, so we have biologists in lots of agencies in the state. Do we need all those different biologists? I will tell you, I've asked that question because I do follow DEQ and DSL and all of the other agencies. And the truth is, the answer that I get from the agencies is they each do something different. And ODF&W's biologists have a specific mission separate from these other agency biology missions. And so if that is truly the case, and I have no reason not to believe that, we have to be sure that we answer people like Senator Johnson who asks those kinds of questions. Then I want to go quickly to, because I know you have lots of business, but we need clarity on the results of House Bill 3315, and I was hoping today to see a report from the agency, and I understand they simply have not been able to put it together yet. 3315 related to, and we supported that, and we've supported it not just because we think that there's some magical dollars that are going to appear because ODF&W gets to bill DSL. Give me a break, folks. Somebody's going to pay that bill, and it's either going to be the general fund giving it to DSL to pay the bill, or it's going to be the permittees who need removal fill permits. And so those conversations are going to need to be had, but it's not magic money that just is going to appear as a result of that. One of the reasons we supported 3315 was because we thought it was really important getting back to that mission and actions part. What do ODF&W staffers do. How much time do they spend on one thing versus another? A few years ago, former Governor Kitzhaber really set up something called the Regional Solutions Teams around the state. But those Regional Solutions Teams are requiring natural resource agencies to show up at those meetings and help with economic development related to those regions. Not a bad idea, but it's one more thing added on to their current responsibilities. So we were trying to say, and we are frankly asking this of DEQ as well, what do your people do? Do you know exactly what it is that they do? So that's why it was really important to have 3315. But I just wanted to say that it's not going to be magic money. And part of what you heard when you went to the legislature was you heard legislators saying, well, gee, we want to know what's going on with 3315 because we think there's magic money there. And I just think it was really important. I think that's all. You have lots of work to do and be happy to answer any questions. But I will tell you that one of the things that I do and have done for a number of years is follow all of the natural resource agencies' budgets and policies. So I get the nexus amongst all these different groups. And I really appreciate all the work that you have done on this. But we need more detail in order to be able to make a success of this discussion.
Okay. Thank you, Peggy. Any questions or comments from students? Yes, Rob.
How much vetting have you done of the beverage tax within your organization? Is your opinion a broadly held opinion within your organization?
We have not. However, I can give you an indication that it would be something that we probably would support simply because you may have seen the ads in the paper. Frankly, we are supporting Measure 97. And we are supporting Measure 97 because we believe that there needs to be more revenue in the state. And so assuming that it's a gross receipts tax, but it also has the sales end of it. So one would presume that our members probably would support that. It's certainly less complicated than the income tax surcharge. And I can tell you that there are other agencies looking at their own proposals related to the income tax surcharge and their own, and how many can you do. And we just had measures 66 and 67, which was basically a bit of a surcharge. And that was a very painful process. I just have a feeling that it's less likely to be successful at the legislature.
Would the League of Women Voters support a beverage tax whether or not 97 passes?
I believe so. I will have to tell you, this has not gone to the full membership to say so, but I believe that's the case.
Any other questions, comments? So I can tell you, Peggy, when we asked the department for a detailed budget breakdown, they did provide us some spreadsheets that actually, that $9 million they talked about, it does detail position by position. I'm sure Roger could get you a copy of that if you'd like to. So there is some actual pretty detailed stuff, at least that I've seen. And then on 3315, Roger's going to be giving an update on that today, so we'll be able to add a little more meat on the bone for that, too. So
thank you. Appreciate
okay.
that.
Okay, thank you. And is it Fergus?
Fergus.
Yes, sir. Come on up and we'll hear what you have to say.
I'd like to thank the task force for the work you've done trying to accomplish an impossible job, mostly because you're being asked the wrong question, which is how to support a failing agency, when really you should be asking what's wrong with the agency and how can Oregon develop a forward-looking and successful and resilient natural resource policy. I'll give a proposed solution to the funding question and also a long-term solution. The short answer is the $40 million can be achieved through reinstatement of the timber severance tax that was phased out in 2002. You might ask why and how would that work? Timber has been a very important part of our economy since the founding of the state, but it's a declining industry and it impacts two very active and promising sectors of recreation and also carbon credit storage. The timber industry actually has an impact on fish and wildlife. Perhaps you know that Oregon is the only state presently being sanctioned by the EPA for its inadequate surface water management policies, specifically the Oregon Forest Practices Act. The state will lose $1.3 million in water quality funding this year, that amount to be increased every year until the Oregon Board of Forestry changes Forest Practices Acts to comply with the Fish and Wildlife and NOAA regulations. Something the Board of Forestry shows no indication they're probably going to do.
Well, sir, if I could get you to clarify related, if you could provide public comment that relates to what our task force is, we'd appreciate that.
Thanks, Mark. Okay. This is an impact the Department of Forestry has on fish and wildlife. Funding from the Department of Forestry, from the forest sector, logically could apply. In addition, the timber industry has an enormous impact on big game and ecosystems through its vast, uncontrolled chemical experiment of herbicides, which has never been scientifically validated. And we see chronic wasting disease, hair loss syndrome, elk hoof disease. But aren't these possibly part of a much bigger issue? And does that not impact the fish and wildlife? And why isn't there science? I was a tree planter when they started spraying herbicides in this forest, and I can tell you, they loaded up the drums of Agent Orange, transported them from Vietnam to here, and sprayed them on our forest. There was no science involved, and there's never been any ecological analysis of these impacts. The answer to how this would be accomplished would be suspense of the authority of the Oregon Board of Forestry and the Board of Fish and Wildlife, who are the biggest obstacles to change, a temporary appointment of a manager who would combine those agencies with the OWEB, which is a much more adaptive and functional system for wildlife management, and also the surplus revenue could fund, besides the scientific research on herbicides, the needed work on global warming, which has a mandate to monitor forest practices in the state. This particular approach to funding would have the interesting benefit of a recent Supreme Court ruling that reinstating a previously granted tax break is not a tax measure and can be achieved by a simple majority in the legislature. Thanks and good luck.
Okay, thank you very much. Carl Finley from Corvallis.
My name's Carl Finley. I'm from Corvallis, and I have a very short comment on the tax surcharge issue. Under the scenario where high-income taxpayers can basically reduce their tax load by buying licenses, and I'm talking specifically about fishing, that's my field, it's obvious that it brings in less money, but it also moves money from conservation to the department's budget, production, and consumption. There's a shift that way. That's it.
Okay, any questions on that? Okay, thank you, sir. Anybody else would like to provide some public comment? Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob Olson, I'm just speaking for myself today, but I also wanted to thank you for all the work that you have done and made a real contribution to this whole subject area. Brought a lot of things to the table. It'll be important, and you deserve a lot of credit for what you've done. As you know, tax proposals can take a long time to enact and be implemented, and so I think in this room there are people that need to keep working on whatever you recommend, and whatever progress is made in the short term, it needs to be pursued in the longer term, because these issues will continue to be there. The other thing I wanted to mention was that it is important to follow through in acknowledging the long-term contribution that has been made to conservation programs. And these contributions have come in a large respect from licensed purchasers. And having a future fee reduction in your recommendations is one way, I think, to follow through on this. So, again, thank you for your good work.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Any comments for Bob? Okay, seeing none. Anybody else? Okay, thank you very much. We're right on time, too. Let's now move to stakeholder outreach, the status, schedule, outreach, discussion of input received, implications, contact with legislators and additional stakeholders. So I think I'll start with Jim. Maybe you could kick it off, and then we'll have members go around the room and talk about their outreach that they've had so far. And we've also, we've got a copy. You should all have a copy of the summary of the outreach and various comments that were made at the various meetings from staff that put those together. So.
Yeah, I'll just note that since your last meeting on September 16th, there have been at least 8 additional presentations made, and I think we have members of the task force who were part of all of those presentations, so I'll just pass it along.
Okay. So let's start around the room. Jim, did you, since the last meeting, have you had any, Jim? Jim Martin. Have you had any?
No.
Okay. Carrie?
Well, we went and just briefed Travel Oregon.
We did?
It was more of a briefing, though. It was not an interactive, and it was simply briefing the director. So I don't know that really there's much to share.
But it was good because at least they're up to speed, understand the issue that we're looking at. So, Nancy?
Is it?
You've got one coming up.
I have two coming up.
So go ahead and...
Oregon Business Association, Oregon Business Council, but I'll meet with them after the election.
Okay.
No update.
Let's see, Mark, you and I met with the City of Portland Science Integration Team. I believe that was after the last meeting.
I think it was, yeah.
And very good meeting. These are city scientists who support the scientific work of various bureaus of the City of Portland. A lot of good feedback there. There seemed to be stronger support for the beverage container surcharge options for several reasons. One is that they saw a nexus, a fairly strong nexus, the impact on the environment of beverage containers, et cetera, and that it taps visitors from out of state. And then they also, I think one of the other takeaways is they felt pretty strongly that people who have hunting and angling licenses should not be exempted. And let's see, then Roger and I gave a presentation just, I think it was last week, at the annual meeting of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts, and they had some of their board members there and their executive director. And again, it was a small group, but a very good meeting. One of their main interests was the grants program that is part of the thinking of something that would be receiving new money. And they recognized the fact that they do a lot of on-the-ground habitat restoration work, and so they're very interested in that aspect. They did support the reduction of license fees to reduce the impact on hunters and anglers, and they thought that that was a great way to get support. They did seem to favor the beverage tax option. They saw a strong nexus there, and they thought it was easier to kind of understand and administer. And then they would like a presentation to be given at the Oregon Conservation Education and Assistance Network meeting next May. And again, who knows where this is going to be then, but that's a meeting that'll have about 400 plus people there, people affiliated with soil and water conservation districts, watershed councils, etc. So there's a great opportunity there depending on where we are in the process. And then let's see, Jim and I are going to give a presentation on November 12th in Corvallis to the Oregon Audubon Council, and this is an annual meeting of all the Audubon chapters in the state of Oregon. This is their fall meeting, at which time they set up their conservation agenda for the coming year and also identify legislative priorities. So.
Okay, great. Rob? Okay. James? Nope. Kenji? Okay.
Yeah, Roger and I
made a presentation before the Outdoor Recreation Leadership Group that's been brought together by Travel Oregon, and the notes pretty accurately reflect what we talked to. There wasn't really any sort of preferred recommendation because we didn't ask that question. But one piece that of feedback that was given was the new presentation that was presented was actually really, really good because it identified the need, what sort of goals were in mind, and what would be done with the money. Because before, it's sort of just asking for the money. Now it's like, this is what we want to do with it, which made for a more compelling argument that whichever funding scenario is chosen, it'll be put to good use. So, Roger, anything else?
Okay. Since the last meeting, I was able to attend the Coastal Caucus with Jim was there, I think Roger was there, and Representative Helm also joined the Coastal Caucus, and that's the group of legislators along the Oregon coast. We got about 15 minutes on their schedule just prior to the interim legislative session and had a good talk with them. Summaries in the handout that you have. Also testified before the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, and then the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources, giving an update of where we are. A lot of really good questions, a lot of really good input, a lot of, you know, digging into the detail about where's the nexus with what we're trying to do here. One comment that I really appreciated was that we are helping, because we're a legislative task force, I can't remember who it was that said this, but I think it was one senator that said, you know, we appreciate you putting a legislative hat on and thinking about how would the legislature react to some of these questions that come up as we are working on this, rather than just saying, well, we're just representing ourselves. I think we're also looking at, well, how would this fare with the legislature politically? And so I think that's what we're trying to do, is it gives them something that has enough meat on the bone again to try to figure out a way that we can get this through the legislative process, whatever that is, whatever we come up with. Then a number of us, it was Jim, myself, Roger, and Brett met with the governor's natural resources staff in the governor's conference room. They gave us, half hour, was it? Yeah, half hour on the schedule. I thought that was very good. It was pretty much the whole governor's leadership staff. So we had a really good conversation about the bill, talking about details of the bill and what we were working on so far. I would say there was general, I don't know if it was support for it, but, you know, thank you. This is really good stuff. We appreciate you working on it. Anything to add, Jim or Roger, on that? Nope. Okay.
No.
Okay. And then I also, Jerome, I talked to the Oregon Cattlemen's Association on September 23rd in Newport. I thought it was also a good meeting, well attended. Of course, the cattlemen, they first want to address any budget increases, want to see more folks in the field to address their needs, need to consider the exemption for owners that house Oregon's fish and wildlife. They'd like to see more surveys done to accurately determine the numbers of fish and wildlife. Want to see dollars allocated to repairing damage from Oregon's wildlife. But overall, I think, Jerome, correct me if I'm wrong, my comment is they very much appreciated coming and talking to them, getting them up to speed on the House bill, and appreciated the presence. Is that fair?
Summarized it well.
Okay. And then I've been talking to the Oregon Farm Bureau. And I think I'm going to be on their agenda for their annual meeting coming up later this month here in Salem to talk to them about the bill. I've been talking to one of their board members. He said he has some questions prior to the meeting, so he and I have been talking back and forth, and so I'll probably be I'm going to be invited to attend their annual meeting and talk to them about where we are too. So, okay. Anything else on outreach? Jim?
So you also survived two presentations to legislative committees?
I talked about that. I didn't go into detail, but I said I testified before the House and Senate committees. So you must have.
And we have a summary of both of those.
Yep. Yep. Everybody should have received the summary. So.
And then there was one more presentation by Merrill Reddish to staff with Land Trust Alliance and Carol indicated that the Alliance would be expected to support either one of the funding concepts. They were very interested in ODFW expanding the pool of biologists that they have, and then hunting and fishing education for youth, and they asked to be kept informed.
So any additional ones that anybody's aware of other than that we've already talked about? Roger?
Or just two that are coming up, just as a heads up. Next week, I'll be on a panel with State Parks and Recreation and Marine Board with the Outdoor Recreation, Parks and Recreation Association. It's a general discussion about funding for recreation in the state, so we'll be talking about the task force work and what the task force has been doing. And then later in November, Washington Department of Fish, or the state of Washington, is kicking off a similar effort to this task force, and I've been invited to come up and kind of do an overview of what this task force has done and a presentation on where you are in the recommendations to kind of help provide some context for them. They'll also be hearing from the Blue Ribbon panel folks and some other states on their efforts.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so now let's move into what I would call the meat of the agenda, and that is let's start with the work group input, the options to the income tax surcharge exemption, the beverage container surcharge consideration, the political challenges associated with that. So we've had a work group that was called together in fairly short notice. So Jim, I'm going to turn it over to you to, if you're okay with that, to summarize the work group and then.
Sure. Before we do, I noticed the senator was.
Oh, do you have a question, Senator?
Mark, I just had a comment. I thought you did a very good job in providing the information to the Senate and Coastal Caucus that I was in. I didn't know I've been a ringer on the Coastal Caucus for 10 years.
Because of that but, river.
I think that really want to pay attention, the task force wants to pay attention to the questions that were asked both in the House and the Senate side and also in the Coastal Caucus about the cost of administration and duplicating programs and projects and within the agency and also between agencies. There's a lot of concern about House Bill 3315 and that first report on that, I think Roger's due in, on or before January 1st next year.
We'll be doing
so
it.
Should be getting there. And finally, as you know, Mark, you would want to ignore Senator Johnson's concerns at your peril.
Senator Johnson is a personal friend of mine, so I will not ignore her comments, I can guarantee you. She and I are joined at the hip on a lot of issues. But I'll read you just one of the comments that was I thought was a little bit hilarious, but I appreciate it. Senator Edwards started off with the committee presentation. He says, "Don't beat up on the task force chair. He's just the messenger." So that's how he started out the meeting. So that I guess he set the tone for don't pick on the task force chair too much. Okay, let's move into the stakeholder, the subgroup, and the subgroup task force work.
Sure. So at the September 16th meeting, there was discussion about working further on options to a license holder exemption with the income tax surcharge. And staff convened a small work group, and we brought in some of our outside advisors as well as several task force members. So,
if I could pause you just for a second, everybody should have a copy of what Jim's. If you could pull that up, so make sure you can follow along.
It's dated October 12th. It's a summary.
I'm sorry.
I don't have that packet. Do you have it, Kenji?
Do we have an extra copy? Okay, yeah.
If there's a couple more.
Kenji, did you have one? Let's make sure everybody's got one, because I think that's what Jim's going to go through. Do you have one more?
My iPad, but that's
one more.
This is the one dated October 12th?
It's dated, October 12th update.
Oh. Or is it October 28th?
Or 28th, excuse me. I'm sorry. October
28th. No, it's...
Came in an email 1026 from Jim.
Actually,
it's
two.
Yeah. Summary of the work session. Nope.
Okay, Jim, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's dated October 12th. It's called work session.
I'm okay. I have it electronically.
Okay, thanks. So Rob Ball and Bruce Taylor on the phone and Paul Don Hefner participated, and then in the audience, Adam Meyer. And so we asked this group just to give us some informal advice on three things. One is for the proposed income tax surcharge, what kind of alternatives should we look at that would acknowledge the historical contribution of anglers and hunters to funding conservation efforts in the state? And secondly, for the proposed beverage container surcharge, you know, how do we structure a proposal that's a win-win for ODFNW and the beverage industry? And then third is just give us, you know, your lobbyists, our outside advisors were lobbyists, share with us your thoughts about the political feasibility and political considerations associated with the two measures. So as Peggy noted, when we have these conversations, we tend to spend most of our time talking about license holder exemptions, and that held true here as well. And there was not full consensus, but I would characterize it as general agreement that a viable option to the exemption could be a rollback of the second and third license fee increases that are proposed. But that would need to be coupled with a number of things. One is that we need to better identify how the money that's allocated in the $80 million at the moment, that's our funding request. There's $9 million in that that's targeted for enhancing hunting and fishing opportunities. The group suggests we need to do a better job of articulating what that means. Third is that we need to highlight the intended increase in marketing of hunting and fishing opportunities as part of our marketing budget, if you will. And then there's also the proposal that you've already endorsed about indexing future license fee increases. There seemed to be general support for that. On the beverage container tax, there seemed to be consensus that we really need to sit down with the beverage industry and query about what their issues with our proposal are and what would be needed to make it a win-win. And it was suggested we should use legislative members to facilitate that conversation.
Yeah, and I, you know, just jump in there. I think if it's okay with the task force, Jim and I'll get that meeting set up, and so we can sit down with them and say, you know, we're serious about this, so we're thinking about this, and we want to know if, you know, is this dead on arrival, or is there some potential here that we can work together to get something that you would support. So I'll take the lead on helping with Jim getting that meeting set up with the beverage industry, because we do need to sit down with them and have a good conversation. So.
And then in terms of the political feasibility of the two funding alternatives, there wasn't clear consensus which of the two is more politically feasible, although I would suggest the majority of those present suggested the beverage container surcharge is a harder sell than the income tax surcharge. The consensus was that they're both a hard lift. It was noted that we can expect the other natural resource agencies to want to glom on to whatever our proposals are, and that there was a very strong expectation that if we were successful in any of our funding proposals, we could expect to lose the current general fund contributions to ODFNW. So that if the legislature agreed to this additional funding through either the income tax surcharge or the beverage container surcharge, they could expect to lose the current $30 million plus general fund contribution.
I might just add, if I don't say this, I'll forget it, but when we were talking to the governor's staff, Richard Whitman really quickly jumped in and said, well, you know, there's other state agencies that kind of might like this idea that you're doing with ODFNW, so we might want to add on. So it was definitely on the mind of the governor's staff about, well, there's other agencies out there that might. So the governor's at least looking at that from a budget perspective also.
Called the little red hen.
So we have several members who participate in that here, and I've shared with you my take home. I need to make sure that they're comfortable with that, and they may have additional observations. So I'd recommend we get those comments first, because this is going to lead us on a path and re-examining several of our recommendations. So.
Okay, well, let's go with Paul, then Rob, and then Bruce on the phone. Any comments?
Yeah, my takeaway from that, I don't know that the beverage tax was that much harder a sell coming out of that meeting than the income tax. I think it's a lot more complicated. I think, as Peggy was saying earlier, you know, it's a lot more complicated with exemptions and, you know, buybacks and this and that and the other thing. And I'm not sure that I have to circle around with my group middle of this month, but depending on the outcome of it, I'm not sure that hunting and fishing groups are going to want to support an income tax increase that only, you know, gives you a couple dollars off your future license. You're going to pay, you're just paying more. You're not really getting much out of the bargain, as I see it. So that's I think it's a tougher sell, the income tax.
Okay. Rob?
I think the biggest uncertainty coming out of that conversation in my mind was whether the income tax would be supported by hunting and fishing interests, regardless of whether there were exemptions or not, and whether the proposed rollback in license fees for the second and third increases would be sufficient to attract their support. I agree with what Paul said about the relative political feasibility of beverage tax versus income tax. I think the beverage tax is going to be a heavy lift, but it's more feasible than the income tax. So I think that's my shorthand version.
Okay, thank you. Bruce?
Yeah, I think it's been pretty well covered in terms of the substance of the proposal. What I like about the direction that we headed coming out of there is simplifying the way it is to explain this, trying to explain, you know, kind of the enhancements for hunting and fishing and the buybacks and all that. Just being able to say quite clearly part of what's in here is eliminating the need for at least two fee increases. That simplifies things a lot. We don't have to deal with exemptions. And, you know, as I sit and watch and ponder all this, I probably am beginning to think the beverage may be, if it's not any easier, but more likely or less unlikely to be an option to go. But I like giving the legislature two options rather than giving them just one way to say no.
Okay.
And Adam was a participant as well.
Yeah, I think everybody's said most of it already. I think that one of the balance of the two options, one of them would probably be harder, the bottle tax, a little bit harder within the legislature's sort of scope and body, and potentially might be easier out of the ballot and vice versa. But I think the most important thing that hasn't been said yet is that we all agreed that without the hunting and fishing community and the conservation and other communities all on board with the option, nothing was going to move forward. And so the most important thing is that we come to the table collectively and together, and not kind of fighting amongst ourselves, because it's going to be such a hard lift, no matter what, whether it's through the legislature or at the ballot later, that if we don't have a united front, then that's game over. So.
Yeah, good comment. Tom, you were there, weren't you?
Yeah, I was there. Yeah.
Any comments?
Yep, I'm sorry, Tom.
Yeah, well, that's right. You called me up an hour before the meeting to tell me that I should be there, so you forgetting me is not exactly...
I was down in Salem for another meeting, and Jim texted me an hour before this meeting that maybe if I was down there, it's come. Luckily, I usually spend 80% of my time in Salem. So I have reservations about the bottle deposit, not because it's not a great idea, but my fear is the bottle industry lobby. And I think a point that we made that it's a good one, and I think it came out of George, is that we need to sit down with that bottle industry lobby and find out where they're going to be at. Because I don't disagree that it's probably a better idea than the tax surcharge. What bothers me is that's a very powerful lobby that's already adding 5 cents to deposit that's going to impact their industry. How are they going to react to propose changes? So I think having a conversation with that lobby and seeing where we can come up with agreement is very important in moving that forward.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Paul.
One other thing that with the income taxes, and I think this is really a killer for it, is that I'm not sure you can dedicate it to fish and wildlife. And if you can't dedicate it, then I think it's really a deal breaker. And if it's just general fund coming out of income tax, might hold for the first year, but as you go down the road, it's anybody can grab it for whatever reason. And I think unless you're going to have a dedication mechanism with this funding thing, it's kind of a waste of time.
Jim?
But wouldn't that same point be related to the bottle tax as well? I mean, you can't dedicate it either.
I don't know. That's a good question. You know, I think maybe you'd have a better chance of dedicating a bottle, a beverage tax of some sort to a specific thing than income tax, because income tax is just basically general fund.
I don't see how one is easier than the other. I think your concern relates to both of them.
Well, I think it's a discussion that needs to happen.
Well, either one could be converted to a constitutional amendment if the legislature chose to do that, to refer it as a constitutional amendment.
James, then Kenji.
Question to start with. If there is a decreased license cost, does that then decrease the amount of money the state gets from Pittman Roberts and Johnson Dingle, et cetera? No. So it's just about the number of license holders,
yep,
not how much we charge?
Yeah, no impact.
Okay. And then in reading through this, I want to talk from the experience of dealing with a couple hundred hunting and fishing clients this year. The Columbia River Basin endorsement, just because that came up here, that's a real point of contention, especially in Northeast Oregon. One of the rivers I guide on is the Grand Ronde, which flows into Washington. And if you buy a Washington license, you have to buy the Columbia River Basin endorsement again. And that's something that that those fishermen don't even really believe in subsidizing gill netting, the sports fishermen that are paying that license. So that's a real point of contention. And then in talking with these clients about these two options in particular, there's a lot of support for an income tax surcharge amongst these sportsmen. However, if there's not an exemption for license holders, unilaterally, sportsmen are not going to support that, just in the experience that I have with these couple hundred folks.
Okay, Kenji?
So on the beverage tax piece, one of the thoughts is, yeah, both will be a heavy lift, but if we can get the beverage industry on board, it's going to be a lot easier. So it's super critical that we get them on board, especially early on in those negotiations, and try to figure out if there's something else, maybe not on the revenue side, but something that could be brought up during negotiations for any sort of bill that could be brought up as an incentive. Whether it be reduction in cost, some sort of regulatory decrease that'll reduce their cost of doing business, or any other potential carrots that could be offered, because AB's right here, and I'd love to get their support in something like this too.
That's going to be key. So, just for the record, we've been joined by Director Belcher. Glad to have you here.
Apologies for my tardiness.
Well, I heard you had another meeting, so as usual, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to see if we can. We have reached consensus a couple times, and I just want to do it one more time just to make sure. The consensus that we reached is we do want to move the two proposals forward still. Is that correct? We know that there are some issues, but we still want to move those two proposals forward. Everybody's good with that. So we're at least good to go there. An FYI, later this month, myself and Jim and Roger are going to meet with Representative Barnhart and Representative Witt. Representative Barnhart is chair of the Revenue Committee, and so that's where any of the revenue bills will start. So we're going to start having preliminary discussions with him to see where he's at and his comfort with whatever we decide. So we'll be doing that later this month. So. Okay, so, yes, sir.
When you say consensus to move both forward.
Well, whatever they look like. We haven't decided that
yet. The devil's
yet.
In the details.
Yep,
so.
Yep, but at least the two, we're going to move the two concepts forward. So now we need to kind of narrow down what are we going to move forward. So.
Okay.
Jim, do you have a?
Yeah, there's kind of some tiered decision making here. That's the first, let's call it preliminary decision. There's two concepts moving forward, confirm that. The second is for the income tax surcharge, what is the acknowledgement of the historic contribution of hunters and fishers? At your last meeting, you said that was a critical element of that funding proposal. And we've had on the table a number of approaches to that, an exemption. Now we have some alternatives to that that are proposed. The third piece relates to the funding target. So we've had a funding target that we started with $86 million per biennium. And a couple meetings ago, we went through the exercise of reducing that down to about $80 million, 79 something. Staff is now proposing to, if you choose to recommend to the legislature that the second and third tiers of license fees are eliminated in lieu of a license holder exemption for the income tax surcharge, then we would need to bump up that target back to the original 86, which staff would recommend. So that's the we would need to take action on that as well. So by eliminating that revenue, we need to generate more revenue through our funding target. That in turn leads to our need to make some more adjustments to the projected revenues coming out of the two funding measures. We gave you a paper from Christine that was an updated projection of what the amounts of a income tax surcharge and a beverage tax surcharge would be.
And that's the document that's dated 10/28/16.
So anyway, all of this fits together. These are all pieces that fit together. And probably taking them one at a time allows us to put the jigsaw puzzle together.
Senator Whitson?
Yeah. On the regarding the beverage sales tax, if I read this literature correctly, you're not taking into consideration the addition of a whole plethora of beverages in 2018 when the last bottle bill kicks in. And I'm wondering, are you not going to collect that money, or are you going to put that in your pocket, or you're going to, I mean, somebody needs to explain that, where that money is going to go, how much it's going to be, or, you know, give some estimate of how much the money is going to be there, where it's going to go, and what it's going to be spent for. And then, Mark, I'm getting hard of hearing, but did you say that the governor and her staff are looking at using targeted sales taxes to fund natural resource agencies?
No, they were. What I meant to say was Richard Whitman, who was at the meeting, said this might be a good idea for other natural resource agencies who are also lacking of funding, some of these concepts. So, in other words, if you had an income tax surcharge for ODF&W, maybe, I'm putting words in his mouth now, so I've got to be a little bit careful, but maybe we could add a little bit more and fund Department of Forestry's LAC or DEQ or Water Resources or whoever. So
That's what I was afraid he said. And then,
well, I knew this was going to happen. I mean, parks and all those. I mean, they're going, ODF&W's got a good idea here. Let's jump on.
And then I would make one further comment on the $6 million buyback for the third license fee increase. I'm not sure why the hunting and fishing industry would buy into that. I really not. I mean, their purpose, one of the reasons, one of the methodologies of getting them on board was to provide $15 million a biennium at least to enhance fishing and hunting opportunities, enhance habitat, perhaps control predation, this sort of thing. And now we're saying, well, we're going to have to take that money away if you don't want to, you know, I mean, it's robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah. So before we get to the other question, Christine or Beth, can you answer the first part of his question? Did the notes in the back of the page there on the beverage, did that address the additional?
The estimate originally was designed to include water bottles and other types of beverages, so it would be based on the expanded bottle bill, not the one as it exists now or in a past version.
Okay. So Senator, that looks like it did address that. So. Beth? Maybe not?
It does include water bottles.
Chair. Chair.
It does include water bottles, but it was not my understanding that it includes the new beverages that are coming on as of the 2018. So the, really, I did not understand that. Okay.
So it does or doesn't?
Yes, it does.
So then we need to clarify what the report is.
Okay, are we clear on that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Rob, and then Kenji, you don't have a question now? You had your card up.
Oh, yeah, I just put it down.
Okay.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, the reason I asked that question here on this House Bill 2402 Task Force 1028 update, revenue projections do not include products that are being added to the bottle deposit system on January 1st, 2018. We stand correct.
That was a typo.
That was a typo.
Yeah,
that's my misunderstanding. I take responsibility for that misunderstanding.
Failed to review that adequately.
Yeah. Okay, so is everybody clear on that?
No.
Okay, so Christine, if you could get just a little bit closer to the mic, we're having trouble hearing you, and summarize it again just so we make sure everybody's on the same page with this.
I think that wording, I didn't review it adequately to catch that, but the original estimate did include all of the types that would be under the umbrella in 2018.
Okay, got it. Okay, Rob?
I just have a question for clarification purposes. As I understand it, the staff recommendation would result in an increase of the overall budget to offset the $6 million or so. So you'd have one proposal at a differing level than the other proposal?
What we would propose is we adjust the funding ask for both funding alternatives to the same 86.
And what would the justification be for increasing the other one?
More money. The differential is on page 2 of that 1028 update, down in the bottom in the funding simulation. And Christine may be able to answer this better than I. We have done the projection for what's required to obtain $86.9 million, which would be the same funding ask as for the income tax surcharge.
So it would go from 2.02 to 2.19%.
Well, why would you need that higher level if you're, because you wouldn't need to roll back the license fee increase under that beverage container proposal?
Well, I get good point. And I guess where we were coming from staff was responding to what we heard as a desire of this group to financially acknowledge the historic contribution of hunters and fishers. And so we tried to work that into both funding proposals.
That means you would not do increase 2 and increase 3 under either scenario.
The higher level,
yeah.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Jim?
So my understanding is the second and the third license increase were approved by the legislature, not having these options for rebalancing the broader base supporting a portion of conservation and hunting and fishing supporting a portion of conservation. And what this recognizes is the input of these two proposals, either one of which would bring a broader base of support for conservation, should ameliorate some of the need for that second and third fee increase. That's the logic. Now, I've discussed this. I want to say I was in Missouri running my dog, so I didn't get a chance to work on this task force, this work group, but I would have if I were here, and I appreciate the effort. In discussing this with a number of the fishing groups, I think basically they would have preferred, and I made it real clear they would have preferred, as James and Paul mentioned, that a full-scale offset exemption would have been preferable. But they don't want to see this fail. And they don't want to see a fight between sportsmen and conservationists, because it will add to the probability that this fails. And if this fails, these future license increases have already been approved and will kick in to their detriment. But more importantly, if this fails, we're not going to set a new standard for balance between a broad base of support for conservation and the contribution that sportsmen make. So I believe that in the spirit of compromise, the fishing groups would support this overall proposal and would work hard to pass it. And I don't see a distinction between having the offset of those two license increases for the income tax surcharge, but not for the bottle. I mean, the logic is the same. Whichever way we choose and the legislature chooses to bring a broader public support to help offset the costs of general conservation, it makes sense not to kick those next two license increases in, because they were approved when we didn't have this on the table. Mm-hmm. That's my understanding, and I would work hard to bring the sportsmen's groups on support for this compromise.
Okay. So, Roger?
If I might, there might be some confusion in the way this sheet that's called the work session notes on the back, how that those categories are organized. Just to want to clarify, in repackaging or reframing this, we called out the license fee reduction as a separate category, and that included that the third phase of the fee increase was the $6 million. That had previously been captured as in the improving fishing and hunting category. So it just moved numbers around and parked them in different places in order to kind of do a little better job of explaining what the package is. So that may be some of the conversation that was created, but we cut back on how much would go into improving fishing and hunting. The money is still the same. It's just parked in a different area.
Okay. So what Jim is proposing is a compromise. We know that there's some disagreement among the lobbyists, some disagreement among task force members on this exemption process, whether there should be an exemption or there should not be an exemption. And there's good valid points on both viewpoints. So what Jim has attempted to do here is say, okay, let's look at, instead of that, let's look at the second and third year fee increases and stop those. In other words, don't implement those. And then that still is a benefit to hunters and fishers with this proposal of the going to $86 million per biennium and the funding proposed for the income tax surcharge and the bottle bill. So while it's not perfect, it is somewhat of a compromise. And what I'd like to see is, can you live with it, or is it a deal killer? I mean, that's what we're trying to get at. Can you at least say, well, I'm not sure I totally like it, but I can live with it. I can see where we are recognizing the distinct contributions that hunters and fishers have played by rolling it back. We're still providing adequate funding based, and you see where the funding is distributed on the page 2, how it would be distributed for both. And then we could go with there. So Jim's weighed in. So Carrie?
Well, I actually think it's really fair, because while I acknowledge that hunters and fishermen have paid more than their fair share historically, there are still programs associated with hunting and fishing that are above the baseline conservation work that we're asking everyone to pay for. So everyone pays for conservation, and hunters and fishermen pay to continue the programs. I mean, there's still additional costs around administering the hunting and fishing programs that need to be covered. So I think it's a perfect solution. It's a good compromise. I don't even see it as a compromise. I see it as the best path forward. So I'm enthusiastic about it.
Okay.
Okay.
James?
Most hunters and fishermen in the state of Oregon have taken fee increases as just a natural progression, and they know that they're going to continue. And if we don't impose the tier 2 and tier 3 now, those fees will be increased in the future. So this tax, if it passes, is forever, whether it's beverage or income or whatever. But those fees are going to increase for license holders in a few years. It can't be avoided. So I think that just delaying it doesn't really solve or answer the fact that really it has only been hunters and fishermen who have been supporting this financially up until this point for the past 80 years. So while it is a compromise, I think it's a fallback plan to make sure that something functions, but it doesn't at all answer the concern that there's effective double taxation, whether it's now or a few years into the future.
Mm-hmm. I got to jump in. There's another part of this proposal that you've already approved, and that's indexing future fee increases. So indexing them to inflation or some set index so that you don't have these big chunks of fee increases in the future. So that's an important piece of this. So that you know that, you know, every 2 years or so there it goes up at the level of cost of living, let's say, for example.
Sure. And you know, since we're treating this somewhat like a customer and a commodity, it's important to compare the costs that we have currently with other states, since hunters and fishermen are traveling to recreate. Right now it costs more to get a turkey tag in Oregon than it does to get a deer tag in Idaho at the resident rate. You know, so this is something that needs to be considered. Our prices are pretty high right now. And you know, we just need to think about whether whether non-residents are going to come here to hunt or whether they're going to go to another state. And non-resident hunting and fishing is a substantial amount of the money that we're talking about.
Okay, Paul?
The only fee rollback that the legislature contemplated was the third one, and that's baked into our base proposal. The second rollback only came up recently as kind of a sweetener, an offset to eliminating the exemption in the income tax. It never really was on the table before in terms of the beverage tax or the beverage thing. So I don't know why we would bump that up in that option to go after that second one with the beverage tax. It doesn't make any sense to me. In fact, I would suggest that we even simplify that a little further and not try to play it with 2.02% or 2.some%, just 2%. Just keep it simple. If it means you got to scale back the revenue just a hair, so be it. But you got to keep this thing simple if we're going to sell it, and the simpler the better, I think.
So let me make sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying you would support the rollback plan for the second and third fee increase for the income tax surcharge.
That's the only one that we're discussing. Yeah, that's the only one we should be discussing.
Okay, but the beverage, you would say there?
No second one on that.
Okay.
And in fact, I just keep it 2%. 2%. Keep it simple. Keep it simpler.
That would be
wrong. Try to explain why it's 2.02% and not 2%.
Okay. Thoughts on that, Jim?
Well, we were trying to keep things simple by having the same funding ask for the two proposals. That's why we bumped it to 86. And I agree 100%. However we can simplify this stuff, the better. But I don't think we have a funding ask for one that's different than the other. I think that just creates confusion. The other thing, the third tier, just to be clear about that, was yes, the legislature contemplated not enacting that if sufficient funding was available. Our proposal is that sufficient funding. I think without alternative funding, you're going to end up having that third tier increase. So unless we can get them to enact one of these proposals, you're going to see that third tier.
But you get the third tier eliminated at the lower level, at the $80 million
yeah,
level.
That's correct.
So all you need is $80 million to do that.
And I think, you know, staff were happy to, on wherever we settled, be it 80 or 86, that's the kind of stuff the legislature is going to play with anyway. So I think the important thing is what does that funding target accomplish? And does it meet everything you want it to? Does it get you 75% of the way there or whatever?
Okay, Kurt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to get you all totally sidetracked. I'm an observer here, obviously, or here to help facilitate the process, but I wanted to add a little bit on this discussion of with exemption, without exemption, and the way it's been characterized. It's been discussed as a means of recognizing the long-term commitment of hunters and anglers to funding conservation, and I think and this idea is not new. I mean, there were actually some legislators and other individuals that started talking about a concept like that several sessions ago. And the intent wasn't to recognize that there was this long-standing commitment to funding conservation. Truly there is, and that's maybe a side benefit. But the real intent with the exemption was a recognition that a sizable portion of all hunting and angling license dollars right now, today, go to conservation-related activities. And many of those activities they're not driving directly fishing or hunting opportunity. They're about broad conservation-related activities. And so the concept was that if, for instance, and I'm making these numbers up just for the sake of discussion, I guess, not really discussion, but if the average hunter angler in Oregon buys a $58 combination fishing and hunting license and then buys a $29 or whatever it is salmon steelhead card and then buys a $30 deer tag and then buys a $16 bear tag and then buys a $16 cougar tag and go on and on and on. Out of all, a sport pack costs $185 currently. It's a the exemption was a recognition that those people who are buying those multiple licensed products are already funding a whole lot of conservation. It has nothing to do with their historic contribution, because I could argue somebody who moved here today, they have no history of funding conservation in Oregon. Other people, like perhaps Paul and Jim and myself, and yeah, we've been buying licenses since we were 12. But it wasn't about this historic, reflecting historic contribution. It was about recognizing that the current license dollars, a good portion goes to conservation work that benefits all of Oregonians.
Okay, thanks.
That's it.
Thank you.
My two cents.
Thanks.
I was going to say similar thing, and more importantly, it's about projecting for the future. Because absent this proposal, these costs for sportsmen are going to continue to go up because Oregon's going to figure out some way to do basic good conservation. You can't have hunting and fishing without basic good conservation. Hunters and fishermen do not object to contributing to conservation. They object to trying to shoulder the entire load, and they object to looking at a fee structure out into the future, which is going to collapse the base and be self-defeating. That's the core problem. The reason why I think that this proposal should be even-handed relative to whether it's the bottle bill or the license fee increase is to basically say the same thing. What fraction of support for conservation is going to come from the whole public, whether we buy bottles and pay a tax on it or whether we pay an income tax, and what fraction is going to come from sportsmen? I came to this task force originally with a proposal that sportsmen's fees should pay for sportsmen's services and general fund should pay for general conservation. And if that were the case, sportsmen's fees would go way the hell down. But I listened to Merrill and I listened to other people who said, Jim, that's a non-starter, that's not going to work. And furthermore, sportsmen aren't really pushing for that. So don't even introduce it to the task force because it's just going to create a giant stumbling block. Now we're at the point where people are saying if sportsmen don't continue to pay both fees, they just don't care about conservation. And that's not the case. What we're really talking about is not so much the past, as Kurt said, but the future. We want to create a change in the way the funding structure works so it's actually workable 10 or 15 or 20 years from now. It'll still work. We won't have to reconvene our task force to fix another problem. So I'm arguing let's have an even-handed structure as proposed by staff. I would have liked the exemption. It's clear by the nose counting the exemption's dead. I think we need to show sportsmen some respect, and I think we need to reset that balance between sportsmen's contribution and general public's contribution according to what the staff's proposing.
Okay, thank you. Scott?
Yeah, I appreciate what Jim said and appreciate what our guests from the League of Conservation Voters said, or Women Conservation Voters as well. I do think we're trying to set a balance here. So I see the point from the hunting and fishing community, and as Director Melcher said, the funds have traditionally been gone to conservation. So I think this is a chance to try to reset if we're bringing in different funding sources. It may not be that we figure this out today, but if we do set aside more meetings to look more into prioritizing budget, I think that's where you look at what revenue pays for what, and to really determine if we want to say that conservation should be funded by everyone in the state, then there's a certain cost for everyone in the state. And then over and above that, hunting and fishing, maybe that makes it easier to set that up, and whether that changes rates dramatically or not, I think it's something to think about, because that inequality is in essence what we were all brought here to look at initially.
Okay, anybody else? Kenji?
Yeah, so just out of curiosity, is it going to be department policy in terms of any future fee increases that they'll be indexed to inflation gradually, or is that something that'll come if the funding package comes? Because what it looks like is the structure is stair step right now. And this is what you're looking at is just gradual, right? Is that the new policy, or is that in place, or?
Historically, we've done fee increases on a roughly 6, but sometimes 10-year decadal scale. And so when you raise fees every 10 years, as you might imagine, those are abrupt changes. Our current model, which the legislature supported and is now in statute, is essentially an every other year approach. So in 2016, 2018, and 2020, the fee schedules have all been adopted by the legislature. As part of this discussion, we were talking about a longer term, just transition it into indexing so that we can, whether it's annually or on even numbered years, we can just, the fees automatically adjust based on some CPI or some other index. That's not in statute, and our fees are largely in statute. So I think what this task force was recommending was that that indexing approach actually be adopted in statute, so that in the future it would just be the simple calculation and much more smooth as it relates to the customer's view of those fees.
Okay, Rob, and then Carrie, and then Claire.
Well, I like the compromise. I'm opposed to the exemption for the income tax surcharge, and I appreciate what Jim said, and I think he's speaking just for the sports fishing community. It's not clear to me yet whether the hunting community supports the same compromise, and I think we need both groups to endorse the compromise if it's going to work.
We're going to find that out in just a minute. Carrie?
So for the minutes, I just want to say I appreciate the opportunity to be re-educated, and maybe it's good that sometimes I'm a catalyst for clarifying conversations. And for James, even though we don't want to walk down this rabbit trail, on the very first meeting of this task force, I talked about my concern about the high fee structure, particularly for out-of-state residents. And I was actually told that our fee structure is not that out of line with other states, but we won't even go there right now. I just wanted you to know that I was right there for you.
Claire?
I think that the rollback is better than the exemption, and I think something like this is probably needed to bring everybody together. I just want to make an observation about when we use the word conservation. By no means am I belittling the contribution of hunters and anglers towards general conservation, but I think there's another side to conservation, and that is implementation of the conservation strategy, which has not been supported. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're here on the task force, is because that is a program, a statewide program, that has not been funded, and therefore I think we just need to acknowledge the fact the contribution of hunters and anglers have only gone so far and have not given that program a lift that it really is needed for the state's fish and wildlife.
Okay.
To kind of continue to answer to Kendry's question about what would happen if this moves forward, is we would have flat fees for a period of time, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and then they would start to gradually go up, which buys some time to address some of the issues that James had raised, where fees may be perceived as very high compared to other states. Other states are going through the process right now of looking at fee increases, and they will be raising fees. Washington is looking at a pretty substantial fee increase, so other states will be advancing. Under this proposal, under this approach, our fees would stay flat while some of those other states continue to raise their prices, so there may be some competitive advantage in that.
Okay, thanks. Nancy?
I'm just wondering if you could give us a quick reminder of when those Tier 2 and Tier 3 fee increases were scheduled to go into effect.
Sure. The first phase went into effect in 2016, second phase goes in at 2018, third phase in 2020.
Thank you.
And those are already written into legislation, so they're part of that bill that passed.
So you would see, at least if we were able to, it would at least through 2020 or probably beyond that until you would see a fee increase, maybe 2022 or something.
2020 or thereabouts, yeah.
Okay, Kenji?
Yep, so last thoughts, if it's the structure that Roger says, hold the fees for 4 years and it's a gradual increase after that, I'm all for it. especially since it could give us a little bit of a competitive advantage of not raising fees compared to everybody else too. So, and hopefully it'll bring our prices in line.
So there's a proposal rollback second phase as well? Or just
I'm going to get to that. Okay. So I just want to clarify something with Jim. So the subcommittee and the subcommittee's general consensus, and I'm reading on page one of the work session, talks about this October 12th summary, the general agreement but not full consensus statement, that included both these general recommendations included both the surcharge and the beverage container, right? Is that correct?
No.
Okay. Because I could read that into both.
The discussion of the work group was focused on the license holder exemption period.
But
your staff has recommended a common funding target for the two funding alternatives.
Okay, so that's your proposal is the two.
Yeah.
Then. Okay.
And whether that be 80 or 86, it just needs to be common in what we're recommending. So if you were approving this proposal here that represents a general agreement of the work group, we would need to bump the funding target back up to 86.
Right. Yeah.
And Paul, we were suggesting you just do the same thing for whatever you charge for the beverage container tax. It produces 86 as well. That was all we were proposing.
Yes, Rob.
Well, I think there's a couple of other really key points made in the general agreement section here about better identifying the use of the $9 million targeted mm-hmm. to hunting and fishing opportunities and highlighting the intended increase in marketing. Those two pieces, I think, have to be done jointly in order to get the community on board to understand why they should be buying into this. And if they're not further detailed or defined, then I think you're going to have a hard time getting support.
Okay, so here's, I'm going to have you stick up your cards here in a second. So here's what the decision we're going to be voting on, that we would roll back the planned second and third fee increases. We would increase the funding needed from approximately $79 million per biennium to $86 million per biennium. We would better identify the use of the $9 million targeted to hunting and fishing opportunities, so we'll work on that. Highlight the intended increase in marketing and hunting fishing opportunities, and we will consider other ways to generate hunter-angler support, focus angling dollars on fishing-related opportunities, eliminate the Columbia River Dorseman mobile application, and also indexing future fee increases. So hold up your cards. Green, yellow, red. Okay, I can't believe it. We're there. We got one red. Okay, so the hunters are a little bit, like I'd like to hear your minority report. It's what you,
Mark, don't forget on the phone.
Oh, yes, Bruce?
Green.
Green, okay, thanks. So we have a red card from Paul. So what's your minority opinion here?
Well, I've still got reservations about the, the income tax proposal as the way to go with this thing. I don't think it can be dedicated. I think it's just another opportunity for hunters and anglers to pay in addition to the fee increases, what we're already paying. It's another way, just another way for us to pay. And it, while it does broaden the base somewhat, I guess from the get-go, I was hoping that this process would try to bring other people into the tent to fund fish and wildlife without at the same time jacking up the cost for hunters and fishermen. And, we explored some of those options. We didn't cobble together a group of them. But at the end of the day, this is going to be selling my folks on, hey, in addition to your license money that you're already paying, gee, you get to pay some more on top of that. And I think it's going to be a hard sell.
Even with the elimination of the two fee increases.
Yeah, because I don't think it's not a one for one. I mean, at the end of the day, you're still going to be paying quite a bit more, depending on your family income in that. In fact, you're probably, if you eliminate those two increases, depending on your income level, some people are probably, in fact, subsidizing the rollback for other hunters and fishermen in the lower income categories, because they're not going to pay much of an income tax surcharge, but yet they're going to get rate relief on their license fees. And in some cases, they're not paying much in. So I think there's some equity issues with it. And as I mentioned to you before the meeting, we're going to have another board meeting in the middle of this month, and I'll take it to my full board, and we'll see where we're at. But
yeah, if it would be helpful, I don't know if it would or not, but I'd volunteer to go, and maybe Jim and I would volunteer to go and talk to him, or you could have your own.
It's just going to be a conference call. You know, previously they had voice support for the income tax proposal with the exemption. Mm-hmm. And now it's morphed into something that's different. So
yep.
So I can't sit here today and say that, you know, I have their support to do something that's different than where we were before.
Okay, understand. Totally understand. Appreciate your thoughts. Okay, so go ahead, Jim.
So can I recommend that take a break in a minute, but while we've got Christine here, if we could walk through the update on the two funding alternatives, make sure we all understand what those are.
Okay. So now we want to pull up the 1028 update, that document. Okay. Go ahead, Jim.
So what we've tried to do is better articulate how these would be applied. So at your last meeting, you agreed that instead of a flat rate for either the income tax surcharge or the beverage container surcharge, that you preferred a percentage. So we asked Christine and her staff to take that direction and give us a percentage that produced the $86 million target, or $79 million target. So that's what has been provided you. Some of you asked for more definition on how the estimated income tax surcharge would work based upon different sizes of families and at different income levels. And on the beverage surcharge, you ask for some more definition on how it affects the wholesale price of beverages. So, Christine, why don't you take it over?
Sure. So, this latest version, I have run some new simulations. One would be to increase the...
Christine, you're going to have to get a little closer to pull that mic right up close to you, okay. If you can.
So... There's a new simulation to increase the amount in that first biennium to $65 million from $60 million. And I looked at the percentage surcharge, and that's with the low-income people exempt as well as the net low income was now defined as people who make less than $20,000 overall or people who receive the earned income tax credit. Actually, it turns out that including the earned income tax credit recipients doesn't really change the results very much, so I did include them. It's possible to get an EITC if you have enough children all the way to about $48,000 a year in AGI. So some of those people were included, but it didn't make that much of a difference. The surcharge amount to get $65 million went up from 0.57% to 0.62%. And so there's the fish and wildlife license holder exemption was added, and that would remain at 0.71% for $60 million and 0.76% to get the $65 million. Also, I ran a whole bunch of simulations for various types of tax situations. The first would be a family of four, and that's a couple filing jointly with two dependents. The taxes ranged from the surcharges from, you know, $0 to $85.78 per household, and that was for the highest income level, and the 0.76% surcharge. And so there's sort of the options are laid out there. Added also options for people who are married filing jointly with no dependents, and they could pay up to $88.73 in taxes for that. And so this gets into this territory where people may realize that it is going to be cheaper to go and buy a fishing license, say, than to pay the tax. But at least we don't think the impact would hit quite in the first year, because if it was contingent on the previous year's status with whether they had a license or not, that exemption wouldn't be something they would catch on to until maybe the next year. I don't know that most people are in touch with their accountants a year ahead of time to say, hey, you should go buy a fishing license because your taxes, your surcharge is going to be $100, and you know, this license could save you money. So that first year is kind of written off, and then beyond that, some of these estimates would be a little bit lower if people had strategic behavior. I added the surcharge level for the containers that would generate $65 million, and so that goes from 2.02% to 2.19%. And I do apologize for the misunderstanding. I didn't edit enough to see that I was talking about all containers. Of course, the numbers for this are somewhat uncertain. There's really no official tally of the amount of containers recycled, and the number that I did get came from a presentation by the recyclers several years ago. So to the extent that that has uncertainty, this number is also fairly uncertain, but it's the best available information, the best being maybe not, you know, exactly tallied and pinned down very well, but I kind of did the best I could with what I had. I also looked at some of the new impacts on microbrews, so I added that to the estimates, and it was found that a surcharge of 2.02% would increase the price of a six-pack of microbrew by 18 cents, and the surcharge of 2.19% would increase that price of the six-pack by 19 cents as well. So there's when you have a higher initial price, this affects it more, being a percentage.
Questions? Yep. Nope. Nope. Yes, James?
Yeah, just if there was an exemption for license holders, and people decided that they would rather buy a hunting or fishing license rather than pay this tax, wouldn't we then get those dollars back in duplicate or triplicate due to Pittman-Robertson?
Not duplicate or triplicate, but I mean, for instance, the current match on a hunting license, so you sell a $30 hunting license, we get about $15 in federal funds associated, so it's 50% currently. That fluctuates. Fishing, $30 fishing license, I think we're currently getting around a $9 match, so it's about a third of the value. So it's not, certainly not, it's meaningful, but it's not duplicate or triplicate.
Okay.
Just to clarify, we're not doing the exemption.
Okay, but that's what she was talking about with those numbers.
Yeah, I know. She was just reading from her report, but we'd already.
It's just theoretical.
Yeah. So.
Policy decision.
Okay, Rob.
I'd like to be sure we're all clear about something, because I think I think this document is clear. We're talking about a beverage surcharge, not a beverage container tax. But in the conversations that we've had, even conversations today, I've heard people refer to a beverage container fee or tax.
Right.
And that's just not correct. And I think we need to be all clear about this and use the same language.
Yeah. And I'm surprised Peggy hasn't jumped out of her seat, because Peggy's comments was we got to keep referring to this thing as a bottle tax. It's a beverage surcharge. So yeah, you're correct. It's a beverage surcharge. And
yeah.
So we need to make sure that that's how we talk about it. That's a beverage surcharge at the wholesale level. Okay, so the reason that you wanted to discuss that was just to make sure we're all on the same page with
yeah,
that?
Yeah, this is information for you, and I do want to thank Christine. We've run her through many iterations now, and she's been so patient with us and so responsive. Thank you so much. This is the kind of information we need to have in our back pockets to have conversation with folks because they want to know what it costs.
Okay, so we've done the major decision. We've still got some decisions to do. But the major decision we've accomplished. We still have some work to do with OHA and some others potentially about where we, you know, to see if we can bring them along. But where it looks like most of the task force is pretty much there on that. So now the next question that the legis, you want to take 10? Well, okay, let's take 5 and see in 10.
We're going to have one.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, are we on? Okay, so one of the critical pieces that we heard from the legislative subcommittees clearly and from a variety of stakeholders that we need to identify the nexus between the two funding scenarios and the task force charge, and we got to do a better job of explaining that. And so I'd like to take a few minutes now and hone the nexus message. Staff will synthesize the input in our final report and incorporate it into our presentation materials. So we need for folks to weigh in now and say, you know, how do these two proposals that we've agreed to, what's the nexus to the charge that we've been given? So I've got a couple ideas, but let's start with Rob. So.
Well, on the income tax surcharge, one of the survey responses, when people were asked an open-ended question about how should ODF&W's work be funded, people said general fund. It really rose to the top, as I recall, of the instinct people had for the way people benefited from ODF&W's work and how that work should be funded. The income tax surcharge does that. It's like a general fund. It spreads the burden equitably among those who, whether you agree with the loss of exemption or not, it spreads the burden equitably. So that it's not nexus in the traditional sense, but it is basically fair. In terms of the beverage surcharge, I mean, arguably, we've had a lot of conversation here in our early meetings about the health relationship between ODF&W's work and our task force work and our funding mechanism. And most of the beverages that will be subject to the surcharge have health impacts. And so there's a nexus there. It's if we were talking about containers, the nexus would be clearer than it is with the beverage surcharge itself. So I have a hard time drawing a clear nexus line with the beverages to the other than through health to our work.
Okay, thank you. Claire?
Well, one of the things that I heard during some of our listening sessions, outreach meetings, is that with the beverage surcharge, there's a nexus because even though we're calling it a beverage surcharge, not a container tax, there is the element of environmental impact of containers and waste and things like that, and that visitors also have the opportunity to pay.
Mm-hmm.
With the income tax surcharge, however, I think that a strong case can be made that fish and wildlife belong to everybody. Everybody should pay. There should be an ability for everybody to contribute to conservation of all these public resources. And that's one of the things that I've been hearing, and I can understand. It may be harder to explain that to everybody, but I think we could try to make that case.
Okay. Any other nexuses? Any other ties? Jim?
Well, I think it's a stretch to try to basically say fish and wildlife degradation comes from bottles that are discarded and things like that. I think what we should do focus instead on is the concept here is to have the broadest possible base, so to get the job done of funding conservation, because the broadest possible base of public benefits in terms of not only our livability but in terms of our economy. And these are two mechanisms to get the broadest possible base of support, so you incrementally hit people the least. Instead of very high taxes on a narrow base, you want very low taxes on a broad base. That all produces enough money that we're barely making an investment in Oregon's future. I think that's the nexus we should rely on. And in either case, these are just two different mechanisms to try to get the broadest possible base to get this job done for the future of Oregon.
Okay, Nancy?
I have to say, I mean, that's very well put, Jim, I agree with that. I think, you know, it is certainly a lot easier when you talk about the income tax return surcharge to talk about that it's a contribution of all Oregonians and all Oregonians are getting something out of this. One of the things we were definitely tasked with was also how do we reach out beyond just Oregonians for this? Is there a way that we also recognize that people coming to our state have a footprint in this, and conservation, we want them to contribute to conservation in this state. And so I think the beverage surcharge gets to that a little bit and spreads that around a little bit. Originally, when we started talking about this, we were talking about water, and if we were just talking about water, and I think we can still make a case that bottled water, it does have an impact on our natural resources. Removing that water and putting it in a bottle and selling it versus drinking water out of the tap is an additional just effect on the environment. And so it's just one piece of the beverage surcharge, but there is that as well. So.
Okay. You know, I wish that on the polling that we did, I wish we'd asked the question, and I think I would have known the answer, but if I would have asked the public, would you be willing to pay 7 more cents for a 6-pack of soda to help fund Oregon's fish and wildlife, which you've rated as a critical part of what makes Oregon, Oregon? Would you be willing to pay 7 more cents for a 6-pack of pop? And I would bet that 99% of Oregonians would say 7 cents for a 6-pack of pop to help adequately fund. My take is that most Oregonians would say, I think I can afford that. I'd be willing to contribute to that. And it's their decision whether they buy that 6-pack of pop or not. It's totally their choice. They're not forced to. But if you're given the option and you're going to pay 7 cents more for that 6-pack, would you be willing to do that? And and you're going to pay 19 cents more for your Hefeweizen. So what's that?
They might not be willing to do that.
Beer drinkers might.
Well, and I mean, beer is beer is very resource intensive, yep. Also process. Yeah. So
that's the Blazer game for a beer. So.
Right. It's very true.
So any other nexus points? I see Jim was writing as everybody was talking. So any other ways to tie these two together to say, yes, sir, Senator?
I would just point out that the percentage income tax surcharge with indexing and apportionment is a progressive tax. your sales tax on beverages is a flat regressive tax. Everybody pays the same. Doesn't make any difference how much you, you know, whether you make $5,000 a year or $500,000 a year, you pay the same tax.
Mm-hmm. Yep, good point. Okay, anything, anybody else want to?
Yeah, Mark, so for the, as Nancy said, bottling itself is very resource intensive in terms of water. Whether you're bottling Pepsi products or you're bottling beer or whatever, water is part of the entire process. And of course, ODFW, the environment is of utmost criticality, and having clean water and having access to clean water is actually very important to those industries. So I think there's a pretty fair nexus there. We can always say, like you said, the bottle trash out in the beach or whatever, it's tenuous, but there's a positive perception that that there is the tie there.
Okay, Rob?
Yeah, I think if you go back and look at the documents that were created by the staff when we were preparing the briefing papers, there's some really good language in there that can tie to nexus. That's pulling up here, there's a bullet point, says the benefits of ODFW's programs are shared broadly by both Oregonians and visitors to the state, and the cost of those programs should be shared by all. And there's many points like that made through the briefing documents that I think can support a nexus argument as well.
Okay,
so the work may be done. You just have to go dig a little bit.
Yeah, get that, Jim. Okay, so let's move off the nexus then, and let's move to the next topic, and that is a question was raised during the legislative briefings. We want to make sure that we really address what the legislators told us about how we've factored in House Bill 3315 into our recommendations. So Roger and Bill are going to summarize the legislation on how the department is responding, and then we need to decide how best to integrate that into the task force recommendation. So Roger?
So Bill Herbel, who is the deputy director for administration, who has been instrumental in setting up this process, and his staff has been the ones that have been working on this and doing the analysis on the data, will present the information, assuming we have the technology works. But the hope of this discussion is to help give you some background on the legislation itself, because we've talked about it and talked about it in general terms, but we haven't really outlined what the legislation called for and how it was structured and how it came about, and then provide some indication or update on where we are in terms of implementing the legislation, and then where do we go from here as an agency, and then that will give you some basis for some discussion of how we might address this in our task force report. And there are a couple of points that I have jotted down that would throw out for the task force to consider in its reference or discussion of this particular topic. So
if Bill's ready.
I'm ready, Roger. Good afternoon. As Roger said, I'm Bill Herber, Deputy Director for Administration for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I'll take you briefly through a PowerPoint on House Bill 3315, which everybody should know is a mechanism that was put in place last or 15 legislative session to allow ODFW to recover costs incurred in advancing fee-funded programs by other state agencies and the work we do on behalf of that. All right, so a quick overview. Last biennium, everybody's well aware, we had a $32 million budget gap, and fund shifts were a major part of addressing that gap. And shifts were really looked at strategically to align the work we do with the appropriate funding source, much why you're sitting in this room today. And during the budget process, we heard from everyone that there was a large acknowledgement that we had, our biologists provided broad public support across the gamut of work they're doing, not only to hunters and fishers. And so we saw a significant increase of general funds. And so as part of the legislative process, Representative Rayfield worked with us to introduce House Bill 3315. Like I said, it allows us to recover funds on the work we do on advancing fee-funded programs for other state agencies, and that's a key, and I'll talk about that in just a second. So, mentioned a couple times, this allows us to bill for work, and it, like everybody in this room, once again, it's an attempt to find alternate funding that's more in line with the services provided at any point in time. And the legislation allows us to charge an hourly rate for the work we perform in moving that fee-funded program forward. And it actually takes into account quite a few things, the hourly rate and all the other personnel expenditures incurred above that. So it is the true cost of the service we provide. And it, as well as the biologist's work, it allows us to address all the services invoked in moving that fee-funded work forward, such as administrative costs, clerical costs, capital outlay. All of that stuff can be part of the statement we provide to other state agencies. And as far as implementation details, it's a little bit clunky, but currently it requires an estimate in advance to those state agencies that we're helping on the amount of work we're providing on their behalf before the biennium starts, and then that becomes a line item in their budget, and they pay that in that biennium, and if there's a credit or a debit due, that gets added onto the next statement. Currently, the legislation allows us to start billing in 2019. For our fiscal year 2017 and 2018, we actually start providing statements, so the departments that we're involved with and doing work on behalf of can start getting a sense of how much this is going to cost them, and it gears them up toward this kind of estimate process. So as far as work tracking, to give you a sense of what is considered billable under this legislation, I mentioned it's only other Oregon departments. So you can see DEQ, State Lands, Water Resources Department. So we have air quality permits, water quality permits, stormwater discharge permits, water use license, all these things that we're statutorily obligated to provide some kind of input in. And once again, for only other state departments. Things that are not billable through the statute, work done on behalf of state agencies that are not implemented by fee. So we do a lot of consultation work that we that department isn't charging for, and we cannot bill that work. And then the biggest piece is local, county, federal governments, and tribal entities. All the work we do on their behalf is excluded from this legislation. So in a preliminary effort, previous biennium, we always knew, we had our biologists track their time at a very kind of casual level on the work they were performing, and we knew that they were doing a lot of work above and beyond work directed at hunting and fishing. All the work they do is related to fish, wildlife, and habitat, but only a subset was specifically for hunting and fishing. All the rest of the work encompassed much more things. So we knew there was a large body of work out there, and that's why last biennium, all our biologists were 100% license funded, and we made, as I mentioned, addressing that budget gap, we made the request to get some of that general funded because of the work they do, and we were successful in getting those field biologists funded 25% by general fund, and that's how they're currently sitting now, and that acknowledges that work that they do that's above the hunters and fishing work that they currently perform. And the key thing is right now we do not quantitatively know the portion of work that they do that is directly addressing hunting and fishing and everything else. And Director Melcher always says, we're a department of data, but we don't have the information to know what our biologists are doing day to day out there in the field. And this is the question we want to answer. We know the dollar amount is probably $50,000 to $500,000, somewhere in between, but we're trying to find out what that answer is. And this is allowing us to do this. So when we started with House Bill 3315, as I mentioned, the legislation is a very small piece of the pie on the extra work that they're doing. So Kurt and I, right out the gate, we're like, let's track everything. You know, let's see what these people are doing out on the ground so we really can tell the story of all the... Peggy's giving us thumbs up back here. Really tell the story of everything that encompasses the work they do. So we're having them track everything. Even legislation says it's only if it's a fee-funded external permitting process where we kind of erase that for our biologists, much to their dismay, because they feel they have, you know, a lot more important work than tracking their time at this kind of level. But we said, you know, let's get the information so we can really tell that story, and so we can not only have the data behind all the work that they do, but also the information to really make some management decisions and inform our constituents on where that money is going through. So it's a big effort for our agency. So that leads us into actual implementation, and so we knew right out the gate we needed some kind of task tracking tool to track this kind of data. A lot of the biologists have their little black books where they've been since the 80s capturing everything they do, but you know, buried in boxes and in paper format wasn't going to help us. We needed an electronic format, all consistent, so we can really start data mining that information to make these decisions. So we started looking at what was in place. You know, some biologists were using spreadsheets, some were working on contracts and using some other tools from either federal entities or maybe some other state departments, like ODOT has a project tracking system that we looked at, as well as a couple other state departments, as well as federal agencies. None of the tools actually really fit how we wanted to track time. Most of them were very kind of dictated how you needed to track the time, and we knew this was a fundamental paradigm shift for our agency to track this work. You know, this is native to Department of Justice and ODOT. You know, they're all about tracking at a project level. Fish and Wildlife just hasn't done it that way. So we knew this was a big paradigm shift for us and our biologists, and we really needed a tool that was adaptable to how they did business and not force them into something on how business was driven somewhere else. So overarching strategy for us was something that had to be adaptable to how we did business. And it had to be online using modern technologies. You know, if they're out in the field, we want to be able to capture that stuff wherever they're at. Even, you know, if Kurt wanted to track his time in here, he should be able to log on and get on that. So that was one of the overarching tenets for us. And then most importantly, we had to make sure that the effort of tracking the work didn't become a trackable work item in itself. And we've heard this, you know, out the gate from our biologists when we rolled out some of our prototypes. It was very clunky, you know. A lot of they put in, you know, I did a damage complaint and I did this and did this, and I also tracked my time for like an hour a day. And so we wanted to make sure this was very easy to use and didn't constitute a trackable item in itself, which led to that kind of adaptable format. So we get their feedback and we make improvements and make it more and more streamlined. And our initial employment was to look at district biologists and assistant district biologists. We get the question, you know, what are the 400 biologists doing out in the agency? And so that's the question we wanted to answer. However, we focus on license-funded positions, or basically any position that wasn't contractually obligated to do something specific. So if a biologist was getting contract dollars to do something very specific, we didn't ask them to track their time, because we knew through the contract exactly what they were doing and what the revenue was paying for them to do. So we focus on these biologists that were getting more of these kind of general fund, not general fund, but license funded positions and more fundable dollars. And so that leads us to OTIS. That's what we call our online task tracking information system. And basically it's an online system that has been evolving where they can track their weekly schedule or daily, make tasks, make notes, add files for all the permits if that's involved, because we know once we start sending statements to other departments, we're going to have to, you know, provide the backup on the permit they worked on. And basically it's just a little time card, although we get away from the time card nomenclature because we're really tracking tasks, we're not tracking time. So that's why OTIS is the task tracking information. But, you know, basically they identify things they're working on and then how much time they're spending on it. And this system's actually tied into all our HR systems and payroll systems, and it actually knows for every individual their true cost. So it looks at what's the OPE rate or other personnel expenditure cost for that very individual. It looks at their classification, what's their hourly rate. So the cost getting sent through to the other departments is the true cost of what it costs to put that employee on the ground for that exact hour or that specific time. And currently the system accepts, you know, minutes. I think we're standardized in half hours or 15 minutes because we don't want to get too granular on there. But, you know, the system's very tied into true cost. And move into a little bit of the data before we get there. This is preliminary data. This is true production data, but we've been adapting it as we've been getting lessons learned through the data they're putting into the system, and we'll show you that. And I mentioned a paradigm shift for our agency, and I'll actually highlight on that on the next slide. So all the data we capture at the task level or activity level, I think is what we're calling it now. Group level, but what's the finest one? Activity?
Species. Species is the finest.
Okay, you can see how quick this is adapting to lessons learned. But here we have, currently the system is holding 27,000 hours worth of trackable data. And that's currently, we watch, you know, every biologist report every week, and we actually make sure they report. Yes, Mark?
When did it start? July 5th?
Went online.
1 July.
That's when, sort of, we have...
The 27,000 hours since 1 July.
Since 1 July, but we have the preliminary data before that that hasn't been incorporated. So this system, that the data we're looking at is July 1. We actually have some preliminary data that will ultimately push into there that will, you know, increase that 27,000 hour. But as we've been adapting it, we have to build dictionaries to, you know, what this data meant to nowadays terms. So we're working through that. But this is July 1, the fiscal year. Well, we're approaching this in the fiscal years because as the statements roll out, that's kind of how we're looking at it. So a couple of things to mention. You'll notice program administration is a big piece of the pie, 23%. If you look at this graph out of the gate, you might think we're a bunch of paper pushers out there, but this is actually a sense of that paradigm shift I was talking about. The biologists, and I don't want to over-categorize it too much, but a lot of them are focusing on the hows and not the what. So I did an email for a damage complaint. So they an email to put under program administration when in reality they were working on a damage complaint. So we're getting, you know, we're training them that don't work on the hows, work on the whys. And so they look at, you know, I was on the phone call with a member of the public. No, you were. So they'll classify it as an administrative phone call when, you know, we were training them to, you were dealing with a public inquiry. So a lot of training going on. We actually have a data steward that joined us back here, Martine Reisman. So she's part of the process on not only going through the data and making sure it's consistent, but also looking at the data and making sure the biologists are doing it right. So this pie, you'll start seeing this piece shrink as we not only train them and they start entering data more correctly, but we're going to retroactively correct this data as we move forward. So she's constantly working on the data and massaging it to say, did you really mean this? And we'll fix it. And then they've, you know, there's been a lesson learned there and we move forward. So all of this is changing as we're moving forward even now. Then you'll notice fish is a pretty low percentage. If you look in there, you know, a large portion of our fish biologists have contracts behind them. So a big part of that's not reported because of the work is behind contracts. But once again, a lot of that probably falls in program administration as well. So those are our major groupings. We also look at hours activity, and you'll notice we're only highlighting kind of the big buckets here, but I'm real big on business intelligence tools where, you know, these things just kind of lead you in the questions you're trying to ask, and all these colors look daunting at first when you first fire these things up, but then you can start moving and directing yourself into questions that may need to get asked. And here are some of the big pieces of the pie that kind of stand out. We got wildlife surveys, fish screen and passage. Do we have anything of note here? I think the kind of the highlight of this slide is we do a lot of different stuff. not all of this is permitted, but it's all across the board. I mean, if we went into each piece of these things, there's various activities behind it, various species behind it. We can get to all that detailed data, but the gist of it is those biologists are doing just a ton of work. And I think from day one, the very first time I got a week's worth of data from the biologists, I was like, wow, do you ever do your biology job? You know, do you ever manage fish and wildlife? Because they were just doing so many other things. Another thing to point out is this is just like we mentioned, since July 1, the work we do is very seasonal and cyclical. It's not until a full year that we really start getting a sense of what we're looking at, because we'll see a lot of trends kind of pop up in various seasons as work performed out in the field. One example is like we see a lot of, under I think administrative grouping, the HAZWOP for training, you know, hazardous material stuff, that's kind of on the rise right now, so that kind of sticks out. So it's hard until you get into these cycles to really see what the data is doing and what the questions are being answered. Next we have hours by agency type. I think this is one of the most telling things. You'll notice federal government, we do a lot of work for them. So I mentioned out the gate that we can only charge other state agencies, and you can see that's only 21% of our 27,000 hours currently. And of that, only a portion of that is billable. Currently, out of the 27,000 hours, 300 hours are billable under House Bill 3315. So you can see that's not going to quite pay the bills for all the extra work that we're doing on behalf of all of these other departments. Other things pop out as you start drilling into the data. Here we have
collecting the information.
This private entities. That doesn't include private landowners. Oh, and I should mention, this excludes all fish and wildlife work. We do track the work we do on our behalf, but it's not included in this pie chart. Private is private companies, private corporations, not private landowners. Private landowners are usually in our ODFW bucket. But you'll notice we do a lot of local government work, and we're kind of like, oh, that's kind of weird. What are we doing there? But cell towers are a big piece of the data we're doing. You know, the permitting process for cell towers on local government. So that was something that came out of our data analysis. It's real interesting to start driving in the data. Like I said, very preliminary. We're still massaging it, making sure it fits our needs. But it's going to be a powerful business management tool for us, as well as recovering some costs. As far as what's next, continued enhancements to the system, not only on the system itself, but the data behind it, so we can more effectively answer real quick questions on what we're doing out there. Reports, we have to start providing the statements next fiscal year, but we want to use it as a management tool as well, or a strategic management tool. We want to see what we're doing, where we're putting our resources, whether it makes sense, you know, that costs and benefits of that as well. So a lot of reports from that. And then focus on a mobile application. Currently, they have to come back to their office and log in. But we know a lot of the work's out done in the field, and we can actually capture some additional data if they have a mobile app. They can just go out there, hit the button, and now we've captured geographic extent as well as all the information. And we're capturing not only hours spent, but the classification of the individual doing the work, the species they're working on, if it's appropriate. Of course, the agency and regulatory number if appropriate, but it'd be nice if we could capture that geo information as well, you know, just more information with very little need to extra work on their behalf. And with that, quick run through. I'll take any questions.
Actually, I have two questions for you. So you just mentioned that. Should I speak into the microphone?
Probably.
Okay. So the first question is, it seems like you mentioned that you're going to be utilizing this for business intelligence. Have you started to look through process sort of optimization in terms of programmatic areas? And then the second question I had was, it looks like a great tool that you can look at employee productivity. And then if you do go down that way, will bargaining get in the way of that?
Yes. We've both of those have come up in discussions. The first one, I start looking at the data, process improvements, the first thing that jumps out at me. You know, yeah. I look at it at a, in a different format, and I can see, well, you know, this watershed, damage complaints take twice as long as this watershed. Why is that? You start asking those questions. Are these people doing something so efficient that can be transferred across the agency? And those are things we will be looking at. But then you certainly start getting into the issues where does it start affecting kind of management of employees, and does it become a kind of a tool, like you mentioned? Does bargaining get addressed? You know, when we mentioned to our staff that the system's tied into the payroll system, and that's solely to see the cost of an individual, the first thing they ask is, you know, does this mean if I track more than 40 hours, am I going to be penalized, or, you know, or less than 40, does that cause a problem? Those are all questions we're grappling with. Right now we're not looking at, you know, certainly not the intent of the tool, so we're kind of side-skirting that question, but we are, you know, talking to our HR department on ramifications of that. Certainly it's something we just kind of put off to the side for now, but it will have to be addressed in the future. Looking at the data, just focusing on the data now, but it's a question that we're going to have to address, and it comes up with our staff often. Kurt, I don't know if anything you want to add on that.
Okay,
this about half of your work for other agencies work for the federal government.
Yes.
And you have about a third of your budget comes from the federal government. So, I mean, is there, can you kind of discuss the overlap there?
Yes, this is trackable hours, so it's only half of the trackable hours, which might not, you know, equate to a third of all the work we're doing. So it's really, it's not a kind of apple to oranges question.
Yeah. It's actually worse than that, Senator, because the federal funds that you see reflected in our agency budget pie chart, they come to us with specific tasks associated with them. Those tasks are not reflected in this pie chart. This is work that we're doing with federal agencies that is not essentially funded by federal agencies.
Here in Oregon, we call that an unfunded mandate.
It's worse than even.
There are some employees that are tracking that are contracted, so there's a sliver in there, but Director Meltzer was right. This is above and beyond what we're moving forward, which is why we want the data to be able to tell that story.
Paul?
Did I hear you say of all those hours that you tracked, you only thought there were about 300 that were billable?
Correct.
And that's for 1 year? Or
To
date, 6 months.
And it is reportable hours. And there's a caveat with that. Some of the work we'll spend a year or two on a permitted process, but we won't. But it's in a consultation role where we don't have a permit number. So the system doesn't really see it as billable until at the end we punch in a permit number, and now it goes back and says, oh, all that's billable. Okay. So at any point in time, it's really not, it's hard to say.
But so far you've teased out about 300.
Correct.
So what would you guesstimate as cost recovery for a biennium?
I actually was going to look into that. Have no sense right now. We were going to plug that number in just.
I think in the legislative process, I think I said that it's probably between 50,000 and 500,000. We just don't know where. And I would say that's still accurate. It's not, you know, you're not going to fill a $90 million budget.
It's a pretty low order of magnitude.
It's very low.
Thanks for your presentation. I think it was pretty illuminating, and I think that down the road this is going to, I can see the benefits, and when this legislation, whatever we come up with, passes, it'll, you know, even be more important in terms of accountability and tracking how the money is spent. I do have a question. There was a slide that I think it said 8% of something was spent on fish surveys and 8% on wildlife surveys. I can't remember. Yeah,
yes,
that's it. And I was just kind of curious, is that broken down further now in terms of which conservation species under the Oregon Conservation Strategy are being worked on, or is that something out in the future?
That's actually, we have that now, right?
We do, but we haven't had employees tracking their specific conservation strategy work. They will be in the future because that is an option within each of the larger groups. So within the fish category, the wildlife category, and the habitat category. So they can capture when they're doing
that's one of the areas where we learn, you know, those lessons learned when we go through and look at the data and we ask a question and we're like, oh, we don't have that piece of data and we add it in and that's where we're at now.
Well, thank you. You answered my upcoming second question about the habitats, so thanks.
Rob, I think.
Yes, does the department have any dedicated continuous improvement resources or people, or is the analysis shared by people within their daily job? Ultimately, who's responsible for looking at the data to make sure you're optimizing movement and change?
Yes, currently, you know, we do have two positions dedicated to it, one on the IT side and one on the data side, so we can look at it from that standpoint. But the idea is to get it into that business intelligence model where the executive leadership is the one, are the ones driving it and using the data to make those informed, you know, decisions on the process improvement. We do, the department does have a dedicated process improvement person on board. You know, that's something that can be looked at. We have a lot of kind of individuals looking at the data right now, but the idea is to really make it a management tool that the leadership teams can use and push through the agency, because we think, like Kenji mentioned, there's probably a lot of processes that can be, you know, efficiencies garnered in one area can be applied to another, even if it's not the same thing. We know people are, you know, selling permits, and some people just have it down better than others, and those are kind of the efficiencies we want to move through the agency. So it's really starting at the top, using this kind of BI approach to enlighten leadership on where they can make some very strategic and massive improvements, because once you start looking at the data, it's like, oh, that's what I need to do. And then it changes once you address that to something else. So really kind of start top down. And the staff very much involved. Once we start getting the data really solidified, it's going to be part of we have an internal website, our intranet, that this is going to be part of it, putting the information out so everybody can see what's going on. And a lot of them are curious themselves, you know, how's that guy doing this so much more, you know, very competitive nature on, and do self-improvement that way. So top and bottom approach on efficiencies throughout the agency.
Thank you.
Well, we're at the beginning, you know, we're at the phase where you recognize that if you don't, what you don't measure doesn't get done. You know, we're at the beginning of measuring.
It might help you close the gap between $50,000 and $500,000 to have dedicated resources on the improvement.
So here's the dilemma for me, at least. The 2402 says develop recommendations on whether adjustments are necessary to ensure that relevant department program areas are funded in accordance with the intent and purpose. And we need to, according to some direction we've been given by the legislature, decide how best to integrate the task force recommendations into this. So the problem is we don't even have 4 months worth of data. I mean, you don't have October's data entered, do you? Because it just quit yesterday.
It's real time, so we have October.
Oh, you do. Okay, so you got 4 months worth of data, and how do we take 4 months worth of information and incorporate 3315's direction into our task force recommendations? We can't accurately do that, can we, Roger?
I gave some thought to that, and I think one approach that the task force could take is just acknowledge that there is a connection between the work that's being done under House Bill 2402 and 3315, and point out that it is much too early in the implementation of this to really draw any conclusions.
Yeah, that's really, all we can say is
really do anything in terms of the analysis.
It's
and
good.
If you want to provide direction and recommendations to the department to just reinforce that we continue to refine our ability to collect and analyze and the tools to do this work, and Rob made the point that I just jotted down, is the idea of apply the learnings from this to do that continuous process improvement within the agency.
Yeah, that's probably the best we can do, or at least I think so.
Yes, yeah. And it certainly highlights the breadth of work that's being done out there in the field, you know, that there's a lot of work being done and not all of it's correctly aligned with who's paying for it.
Well, and just timing, you know, there's certain activities you do in the summer.
Exactly.
There's certain activities that are done in the winter, you know, and it's going to...
Yeah, until you truly get bienniums or biennia into this, you're not going to have a clear picture.
Yeah.
Even, you know, the year is not cyclical enough. It's true biennium.
Kenji?
Can we go as far as saying we support the direction that it's going? Because
oh, sure.
The business intelligence piece.
We definitely can do that.
Critical.
Yeah. We definitely support the direction because we're right. I mean, we're getting good information. So. Okay. So Roger, did you have another question?
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
Mark. Yeah, Claire.
And maybe what we could add to that, in addition to support, is just give some sort of indication that we would expect, as this starts to really grow some feet and legs, that we would expect it to be a major tool that is used to carry out the intent of 2402. And as more FTEs come on board when there's funding, that this will be a tool to kind of move it in that direction.
Yep.
And you'll be seeing a lot of, in our Ways and Means presentation, we're going to have a lot of the more detailed data as part of that. So we're going to be getting more and more of this information out for everybody's consumption.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay. Seeing none. But now we're going to move into kind of closing out. We'd like to, I know what Jim's got. Since some things he wants to share from Missouri, it isn't your dogs did really well, did it?
No.
Oh, okay.
Not my dogs.
Yeah, your hunting dogs. Okay. So, is there any other direction that we want to give to staff on the refinements that can be brought back for approval on November 28th? Did we miss anything? Have we left anything out? Any other comments or directions? Yes, Rob.
When Christine was giving her presentation on the. On the second alternative, you mentioned that the data wasn't great or that there are certain assumptions made. Is there a way to get firmer data or a better a level of confidence in the numbers that you're being shown for that option?
No, if there were, I would have done it.
But... Is there a plan to try to get better data or we're just accepting what we have now and that's it?
I had a clarification I need. On the October 12th summary of that meeting, under the talk about rollback of the second fee level, there's an indication there there's logistical issues that might need to be addressed since that second phase of the fee increase takes place in 2018. Alternative funding might not be available to roll that back. So can we get a clarification of whether it's doable or not doable? If it's not doable, then let's take it off the table.
Now, there's some kind of a gap here, isn't there?
It's the timing.
It's a timing gap. That's what we're talking about.
Timing of when the fee increase takes effect and when revenue would be collected.
Yep.
There could be ways to deal with that, including, short-term fronting of general fund or money to the agency to buy that time forward and to fill that gap. There are probably other ways to deal with that. We just haven't had a chance to.
I would just add, suffice it to say that if we can successfully push some package through and that's a problem we have to deal with, we'll figure out a way to deal with that.
For me, it would be just don't implement the entire program. Just phase it in. Because you said you could phase this. Mm-hmm. I've heard.
We will be phasing irrespective of the of this potential funding transition issue. I mean, if there's new programs of that magnitude, you don't just turn a switch and have them going. So, I mean, I think we will deal with that problem if it arises.
Okay. Kenji?
Yeah, just a quick clarification on my Nexus comments earlier. I was just reading the article that Rob sent out for the Outdoor Wire, and it mentioned that there's two top values in terms of our survey that we sent out. The top two values in the ranking are that healthy fish and wildlife populations exist in Oregon, and that second, that Oregon's water resources are safe and well-protected. So there's that clear nexus right there. So I just want to add that.
Okay. Anything else anybody wants to... Related, Jim. Okay.
I just wanted to note that, while the majority of our conversation is focused around a funding need and funding targets, There are a variety of other recommendations in this report. There are recommendations on how we spend that money. And we did work through that in work groups, but we didn't spend a lot of time on that as a full task force. There's some miscellaneous recommendations in here. I just want to make sure that there's a general level of comfort before we start finalizing the report. So what I would recommend is you use the existing report. And Mr. Chair, I'd ask for comments from members by X date so that we can turn around a draft final report for you to review.
Could we do it in the next 2 weeks? That would give you 2 weeks, so we're meeting on the 28th to incorporate those. So if you take a look at the draft, and then if you have any comments, get those to Jim within the next 2 weeks, and then we'll see a final report on the 28th, or a final draft, I should say, on the 28th, that we can see if there's any massaging we need to do that. Because we're going to be testifying before the December interim session, so.
Well, we'll turn around a final draft at least a week before your meeting on the 28th.
Okay, so we'd have something to look at prior to that, okay.
Because is this a good time to talk about next steps?
You wanted to share something about some your Missouri stuff. Yeah, let's go ahead and do that first, and then we'll get to next steps.
Okay. A lot of you know that I've been missing for a month and a half because I went to Missouri running my dogs in the Master National Hunt Test. And while I was there, I had a chance to really sit down with some of the Missouri Department of Conservation people and really look at how they run their programs. Of course, 30 years with ODFW, I'm pretty familiar with how we run our programs here. And I was thinking about some messages, some lessons learned from Missouri, because I consider Missouri to be the premier state where they've had stable, adequate funding for so long. They get public funding from their sales tax that about matches about 50% of their agency compared to their hunting and fishing fees and their excise taxes. So if you think about, you know, what's the model that we're trying to emulate, a model that would bring in half of the money for the agency from public, from a broad base of support, and half the agency from fees and excise taxes, is a pretty good model. And I was thinking, okay, they've been doing this since the 30s and 40s. What have we really learned? And I'd just like to share with the task force a couple of observations, and I think the take-home message for the department is we don't want to go forward communicating this strategy as let's fix a broken funding model or let's fix a big problem. We want a bold vision of change, a bold vision of why people should make this politically difficult decision. And I think we could learn an awful lot from Missouri. If you go to Missouri, it's a remarkable how many conservation areas they have. Just go down the freeway, and on just the average little trip around St. Louis, you'd see turnoff signs for 3 or 4 or 5 conservation areas just on the freeway. And these conservation areas are remarkable. Some of them are huge, like the August Bush Conservation Area. It was bought by Anheuser-Busch and named after the chairman. 16,000-acre conservation area just on the outside of St. Louis. And some of them are just little pockets, a reservoir. But, you know, they're really remarkable in terms of the balance of outdoor recreation, education programs partnered with schools, and just open space sort of things. So they provide habitat, but they really put a focus on people in that habitat. Very, very remarkable. Their communication with key communities is so much better than what we're used to here. It just seems to me that as we think about what are we going to have to do to preserve this money for the purpose that we're trying to get them to set it for, we're going to have a community that defends it politically. Because we can't dedicate it. Paul's brought up several times, it's very hard to dedicate this. The way you dedicate it is you get a community that feels so strongly about this that they fight against any diversion of it, and they're willing to fight every single year in the legislature, because almost every single year in the legislature of Missouri, somebody tries to divert that money, and somebody has to go fight to prevent it from diverted. So what's the relationship that the department builds with key communities that prevents that diversion? There's just so much to be learned there. So I would just challenge us as the department to think about sitting down with key conservation partners and saying, what would be the, how are we going to communicate the bold vision here beyond just counting puffins and counting species out there and implementing the conservation plan? Are we going to reset a new relationship of working together, matching monies, getting ownership of conservation areas, and communicating in a lot more effective ways so that we have that army of people who will help defend this if we're able, ever able to get it done? I spent 3 weeks there just while I was running my dogs, visiting these various conservation areas and visiting with the staff and looking at the morale. I think there's a lot to be said for renaming your agency the Department of Conservation rather than the Department of Hunting and Fishing or the Department of even Fish and Wildlife. And just the tone of the organization says a lot, and the way in which they work with their partners say a lot. So I think there's a little magic moment right now for resetting more than just the budget. And I would encourage the department to sit down with other conservation partners and sporting group partners and saying, how do we articulate a much bolder vision for the future here? And let's sell that. Let's put a communication strategy together that sells that. So I just wanted to share that with the group. If you get a chance, go on your website, go on the Missouri Department of Conservation website. If you have partners in your organizations that work in Missouri, have some conversations with them about the sort of things that basically are required in order to create that army of people who will help defend the funding. Because otherwise, I guarantee you, just the day-to-day slings and arrows of tight budgets will erode what we're trying to do over time. So I just wanted to share that with people. It was a remarkable 3 weeks in Missouri.
Thanks. Claire?
I think I really appreciate what Jim has just said, and I worked pretty closely with all 50 states when I worked for the department. Missouri was then and still is a real showcase. And I would just like to underscore the point that has been made to me in private conversations and in some of the meetings that I've had. It's about what we intend to accomplish with new money. It's not just about funding a department, although that's the vehicle, of course. But in talking to a marketing friend of mine, she underscored that kind of a message too. What is it? What's the vision? What is it we really want to accomplish? And less focus on just funding an agency. And I think that the survey that we conducted back in May kind of underscores that. I mean, we definitely don't want to belittle the role of the agency and making it a premier, you know, organization in the state agency. But anyway.
Okay, thank you. Kenji, or James, excuse me.
Thanks. In the same vein, but even more specifically, if we're going to be selling this to sportsmen, I would really like to know how the $15 million is intended to be spent to increase hunting and fishing opportunities.
Yeah, that was one of our charges, is to further identify exactly how the funds are going to go. So yeah. Now, Kenji.
So, hey, Roger, and Jim, has everybody here seen the new presentation that you put together?
Okay.
Probably be good just to send it out.
So, what Kenji is referring to is you've all received past versions of our outreach presentation, and Roger recently revised that presentation to be more visionary, if you will, and we'll circulate that.
We're going to put a few more. We've got too many fish in it right now, I guess. So we're going to put a few more.
We're going to take out all the fish. I said that for Ed, who's not paying attention.
It's real high on the fish and not enough on the birds and the animals. So Roger said he's going to fix that. Oh. But it is a very good presentation. So we're going to get to public comment in just a minute. So next steps.
I proposed a meeting on November 28th as your last meeting. And so We just talked about producing a final draft report for you to review prior to that meeting. So we'd like to have it in front of you for approval at that meeting. I think what we're looking for is that you're generally comfortable with it. We recognize that a group this size isn't going to agree with every word in every single proposal. The point here is, are we comfortable with what we're referring to the legislature as response to the charges we were given? And so that'll be the question that's in front of you on the 28th. If there are serious points of disagreement, we're happy to forward minority reports too. That'll be your responsibility to write. But you know, if you seriously disagree with an aspect or more of the report, then we'll pass those disagreements along. We're going to ask you to sign the document. So there'll be a cover letter from the chair to the legislative committees, and we'll be looking for signatures from all of you to be on that. So that's generally the process. The document's going to look different. It will have graphics and be reorganized a bit. For example, Claire brought up, you know, stressing more the vision of what we're trying to accomplish. We're going to move that more into the front of the document. It'll look different, and it'll have the most up-to-date information based upon direction from last meeting and today. We'll also resend you all the detailed budget sheets that you had when we had work groups. So Peggy brought up the question of the details of how many biologists. Well, you were provided that, but we'll send that out again so that you have all of that as backup. We weren't intending to have all that in the report. Our idea here is provide the legislature a report that's really no more than 30 pages with a lot of backup information to support it.
Okay, and then we've got the other outreach meetings that are happening, we're setting up, I will, with Jim and Roger, get a meeting with the beverage recycling folks so we can get hopefully an early input into them and find out where they're at and see if we can reach some kind of an agreement with them that they would, the best of all worlds, support what we're proposing. But hopefully you'll give us some power to negotiate with them a little bit so we can hopefully come up with something that they're not going to go into the legislature and say no way, but they can live with what we're proposing. So wish us luck on that one. And then we'll be meeting with Representative Barnhart and Representative Witt, I announced earlier, so that we can talk to them about where we are, get their feeling, because we need Representative Barnhart's definite support and movement as we move through this. And Representative Witt and Representative Helm have both indicated that they're more than happy to help us with that effort. So there's some other next steps. Anything else?
One other thing that I want you to think about between now and the 28th is, what's our role as a task force of moving this forward? We sunset at the end of December. This was a legislative task force report. It's not an ODF&W report. And so it's going to go into the legislative process. And so we need to think about what role we collectively and individually play in that. And how do we build those constituencies of support to move it through the process? So, start thinking about that, because that's our recommendations are one thing, but moving the recommendations forward is a whole other charge to us.
Yeah, and as you've heard me say before, I mean, it's going to be key that for those of us who've worked in the legislature, things move through the legislative process through lobbyists and working with legislators that we know. And even though you may not totally agree with something, I think we can totally agree that we want an adequately funded Department of Fish and Wildlife with the vision that they have for us. And so we can all agree with that. How we get there is what we've been working on for the last 10 months. And so that's what we want to to push with the legislature is we've put a lot of work into this, we put a lot of effort into it, and we're coming together, and we need to get our lobbyists on the same page with us to also come to the legislature and say, you know, this is what we need to move forward with. So, and that's where the heavy lifting is going to happen. So, okay, public comment. Peggy?
I know you all want to get home, so do I. Peggy Lynch, Legal Women Voters of Oregon. The thing I did not share, and I want to thank ODFMW and Director Melcher, please indicate to your staff how much I appreciate the work they are doing on 3315, because that will be so helpful.
They're right here, just didn't.
Well, but no, these are the people doing the initial work. It's the people in the field who are actually filling out those documents that will really help us send a message about what this department does. I just wanted to share with you a few things. So on the list were DEQ permits. For instance, the stormwater and wastewater permitting system has an agreement amongst its stakeholders for a 60-40 split related. They pay 60% of the permit fee, 40% comes from general fund. So when you all are talking about your hunting and license fees and how fair or unfair they are, just want you to get a broader picture. DSL permits don't get any general fund, and if there is a lack of, if the cost that they now charge to the permittees doesn't cover the system, it comes out of the common school fund, because that's how DSL operates. WRD has its own set of permit costs, and they are coming in this session with a new request. And usually they try to do it not every session. So that's, you know, so when this happens in 2019, when they get new numbers, it will be another conversation. Dogami's permits just increased this last session to pay the cost of what's happening with their agency. So I just really kind of wanted to give you a broader picture of this is not just about hunting and license fees. And whatever. Agencies work together. The last thing is the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, of which ODFMW is an active member, is doing an update. And so we will have this next session a group of packages related to how we have clean, abundant water for all. And ODFMW will be a part of that conversation. So I'm trying to say is that there's a nexus amongst agencies, and this whole idea of there's only, you know, we're only looking at ODFMW, and I'm sure that's why Mr. Whitman said what he did, because there is this nexus, and we need to not be myopic. Thank you all for your work. I really appreciate the work you've done.
Okay, thank you. Adam?
Yeah, I'll just take 20 seconds here. And Jim and Mark both sort of talked about this, but I just want to emphasize one of the main reasons why everybody who is here at the table is here is because the governor's office felt that these groups were going to be very powerful in conveying the message after the task force did its job and needed to communicate to the legislature. And so I think it's going to be really important to have this group somehow reach out and communicate to the legislature during the session. And I know that that's beyond the term of this particular task force, but that is one of the key components of having the different groups that are sitting here today here. So as you guys are deciding what to do moving forward, I hope everybody will seriously consider some sort of engagement, whether individually or as groups, after our kind of last meeting. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Okay, Christine, I want to thank you for all your financial help for us. It's a lot of work behind the scenes. You've done a number of iterations, so I want to personally thank you for all your efforts. And I understand from Jim that, Roger, you have an announcement?
Yeah, I just want to extend an invitation to folks for an event coming up this weekend. We've been talking about conservation and partnerships. This weekend is the art show wine tasting at Duck Pond Cellars, and the art show is the habitat conservation stamp art, wildlife art, and then also an upland bird stamp art, judging an event at Duck Pond Cellars 1 to 4 o'clock on Saturday. Wine tasting, great wine, great art, great fun. And there's flyers on the back, and hope to see some or all of you there.
Okay, thanks. So we're, Claire?
Just one other thing. I'm not positive about this, but I believe that this Thursday night's Oregon Field Guide on OPB, at I think it's at 8:30, is going to focus on Fish and Wildlife, the department, and funding, I believe. I'm not sure. I haven't been told this, but I was noticing in their program announcement that that it's on this Thursday night. Tony Schick has been working on it. He's attended some of our meetings, and it'll rebroadcast Sunday night at 6:30.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Might be worth tuning in.
So rather than close with a joke, I want to ask Beth a question. So, Beth, who's going to win tonight?
Oh, that's easy.
Chicago. Okay, we're adjourned.
No, please.
Adjourned.
No, please.
Chicago.
Okay, we're adjourned.